right. Hi, everybody. So today, last week, we talked about the Vedangas, and we went into some depths that I wasn't planning on going, and but it was fun. And this week, my goal is to talk about the Skandhas, the Sadangas, and to talk about karmic theory. And then I wanted to cover the sun and the moon from an archetypal perspective and get us really thinking about the sun and the moon as archetypes. So, and I guess before we begin, were there any questions from last week? I think we're all good, right? we're not going to go to the same depth with the skandhas. So in the skandha means like a shoulder or hip. We don't have a word in English that quite, I think, fits what skandha means. We have our limbs, which are our arms and our legs, but then there's that section that connects our arm. Actually, maybe Jess knows. Is there something, the same word for the shoulder and hip in medical terminology? Nope. So that place where the arm goes to the body, or where the hip goes to the leg goes to the body, that's the skandha. And if we look at a tree, they'll sometimes be, you know, for us, we only have one arm coming out of our skandha, but on a tree, sometimes you have three or four different branches coming out of this one little hub. So on for a tree, there's multiple things coming out of the skandha. For us, we only have one. But so the skandhas, they're kind of big, they're overarching topics or overarching areas of study in the world of Jyotish. So the Jyotish skandhas are Ganita, Hora, and Samhita. And you can turn that off. And if it gets cold, we'll need to turn it on. To hold the power button down. Yeah. So our first is Ganita, and Ganita, and we'll go through them on a very simple level, is mathematics. It's the mathematics of calculating things, we learn Ganita, the most primary aspects of Ganita in school, plus, subtraction, algebra, trigonometry, geometry. And if you think about it, how much of the some of you might not have taken trigonometry and calculus in high school, but I took all the AP whatever, you know, and I never used it again. So how much time we actually need to spend on that is kind of really depends where we're going. And in the ancient world, only if you needed it did you learn it. So in the realm of Jyotish, you need to be able to think mathematically. You need to have a good mathematical mind. And all that goes under the realm of Ganita. And those mathematics, they're found in texts called Siddhantas. And let's see. A Siddhanta text. I'll pick up a Siddhanta here. This is the most famous Siddhanta. It's called Surya Siddhanta. And Surya Siddhanta, let's see. First page I open it up to, we can see that it's showing the spherical geometry. And rule for knowing Shitarya to given Surya Siddhanta is, so it's talking about the angles and, yeah, North Pole, South Pole, delineating all this spherical geometry and astronomical calculations. So there's these texts, and these texts are Siddhantas, and that's where we get this kind of information from. The Siddhantas also talk about yugas and the length of yugas. And later you'll, and I'm planting that little seed because later you'll hear me rant and rave about people that pull stuff from other texts other than Siddhantas, and they call it valid. When for Ganita, we go to the Siddhantas. Then our next skandha, and we'll come back, so if you have any questions on that, this is the overview. Then we have Hora, and Hora is the interpretation of what all that means. All right, so, you know, in Ganita, we're calculating that it's Taurus rising and the moon is over there. What does that mean? So all that interpretation of the meaning is in the realm of Hora. Now, in order to create a program and generate where the planets are and all these calculations, you have to know some of the Ganita. And as we go through in this book, every chapter starts with a little Ganita first, and then we go into Hora. So we're doing both. And the Ganita is considered this masculine solar aspect. It's using that masculine part of the brain. And the Ganita is considered this more feminine lunar other side of the brain. Huh? Hora, yeah. It's you know, what does it mean? And it means, you know, it's this, you're feeling, okay,
you're
so.
And I
want to be careful with the right. word intuit, because, you know, some people like, intuitionally I feel, you know, it's not, we're not just blindly using intuition.
We're receiving the knowledge. It's coming through us.
So, for example, my last client today, it was a woman. She brought her boyfriend's chart in, and he had Moon with Mars in the seventh house, mm-hmm. and Moon was afflicted. Mm-hmm. And so I said, "Does he get angry a lot?" And she said, "No, he doesn't get angry at all." And I said, "Okay, mm-hmm. so he's passive aggressive then." Mm-hmm. And she goes, "Yeah, well, he gets really angry and he doesn't tell me and he goes away and he's all, you know, is that passive aggressive?" And I said, "Yes, that's passive aggressive." So me being able to sit down to get what's going on with her, to be able to interpret, like, okay, this is what it means, this is what it's doing, but how's it coming out in this person's life? How are they experiencing it? Mm-hmm. What's the terminology that we use in our culture for it? Like, mm-hmm. feeling into that, and then how do I talk about that? Okay, so she's got a passive aggressive boyfriend that she wants to marry. What do you say about it? What do you say? Okay, so but that's all in the realm of Hora. That's the moon. So it's not in just random intuition where you're channeling, but because there's a Ganita there.
Mm-mm.
And the
there's
Ganita, it means there's a science there. But now how do we turn that into something that somebody can interpret and digest and it
relate.
Means something and has that relation to?
Yeah.
So intuition is...
We won't use that,
but there's a feeling sense, there's an interpretation
feminine, yes.
sense, there's a...
There's
a different side of the brain that's being used.
But would you say to that client that I would wait if she wanted to get married? Would you tell her
I told her to wait. I said, it's not a good year. I said, oh, it's not a good year for him. You got to wait. Not for another year and a half.
Okay.
And in a year and a half, it's going to
be self-evident.
Oh, yeah. You know, she's been with him 6 months or something. And so he's still on good behavior.
Right.
Yeah. And I told her, I said, if this is going to work, he needs to learn to express himself.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, but that's different. Okay. So Samhita. So Samhita is, and there's tons of Samhita. Samhita means collections of verses. And so there's Samhitas where they collect... Vrikshayurveda is a text I was looking at last week, and it's how to do Ayurveda to trees. So treating the vata, pitta, and kapha, if the leaf is yellow, it's having a pitta imbalance, and you can add some neem tea to the roots to cool it down. You know, so a book that's collecting all of that, that's a Samhita. A book that's collecting, I have this one really fun book that it talks about the falling of the house lizard. So in India and warmer places, there's these lizards that crawl on the wall. And so if that lizard falls and he falls on your left shoulder, what does that mean? Versus mm-hmm. if he falls on my desk, versus if he falls on my couch over there. And so it's this whole interpretation of, okay, this just happened. What's it mean? Let's see. What are some other Samhitas? In Brahat Samhita, which is an astrological text, in there he has a whole section on treatment of plants and gardening. He has a section on how to make glue. He has a section on how to build temples. He has a section on astronomy. And then he has, you know, the other half of the book is astrology. So it's called Brahat Samhita because there's all this other stuff in there. It's
Charak Samhita.
Charak Samhita. It's a collection of, it's not just one little thing, but it's all this realm of health.
One little thing would be a Siddhanta. That's more
like Siddhanta is specifically mathematical.
Yeah, specific. But yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So thereby it has its own special name.
Right.
So when something is having its own special name, then it becomes that thing.
Right.
All right. So we and so Samhita is connected to the third eye. That is where the realm of intuition comes in. So intuition comes into there. So when I interpret it, that Mars and Moon in that seventh house, I'm using the rules and I'm using my feeling into like how that's going to go over with her and work with her. But now if in the middle of discussing that with her, the mailman came and dropped mail through the mailbox. Then and mail is connected to Mercury. So I'd be like, oh, so there's some communication issues that are going on.
Right.
So maybe I should look at the communication and how can they bridge this communication gap to deal with his anger.
Mm.
So that's Samhita. That's where
seer.
That's where the intuition, the third
seer,
eye comes in.
Yeah.
Now, our goal as a Jyotishi is not to get stuck in any one of those realms, but to cultivate all three of those realms at the same time. So as we begin, and in this book, we're primarily focused on Ganita and Hora. In the class, as we speak, that's where the Samhita will come in. Somebody's going to say something, and then I'm going to interpret it. And you know, I at level two, I watch some of my students, and they're making interpretation of omens, and I'm like, all right, they got it. And I never taught it. But it's just something that, you know, it's intuitive. So it's we learn these little ways of working with things. But our goal is not to become overly masculine and we get all super technical and we think that we can plug in a person's chart to a computer and out will pop their future. Right? That would be a total Ganita masculine thought.
Right.
And we don't want to get all into the Hora, just the feminine, where somebody says, well, I look at the chart, but I don't know what it means, but I feel it out. I feel what's going on. And it's great to feel things out, but we want that balance with the Ganita. We don't want to just feel things out from randomness. We want a rule that Mars represents anger. The Moon, afflicted, represents a feeling of over-vulnerability and a hard time, you know, handling emotions. So we see those together in the seventh house of relationship. And so I have a strong base to make my interpretation from. And that's where I'm getting this balance. So I'm not just feeling it out. and Samhita again is Samhita comes from the let's see in the image, from those two eyes both being healthy. If one of those eyes, if one of those ways of thinking becomes too much, we lose the power of intuition. The intuition becomes biased. If we get too mathematical, masculine energy, then we miss the subtle impressions that things are giving us. If we get too subtle in feeling, we're going to miss the technicalities. By harnessing and working with both aspects of our mind, when that mail comes through, I'm aware of it coming through, I'm aware of what the conversation was, I connect it to the planet Mercury, I know Mercury's communication, so there's my Ganita side. Then what do I make of that? I'm talking about, you know, passive aggressiveness, and I put it together, and then the omen comes out. But that omen is coming out with the other two eyes properly cultivated. And the more I cultivate those two eyes, the more powerful that third eye of intuition is going to be. All right. So, any questions there?
Samhita is like, you're saying it's like the third eye.
Mm-hmm. Connected to the third eye, if we, you know, through this.
So,
yeah.
But it's collections of verses.
The external level is it's a collection of verses and various things so gathered.
There's like an internal level too.
The internal level is that intuitive, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Each of these has its external, you know, the external level of Ganita is learning math.
Mm-hmm.
But that internal level is that, what is it? That's the left brain, right?
Right.
It's that left brain activation. And the Hora, the external level, is all these Vedic astrology books that say when Venus is in the seventh house, when the person gets married, it will be raining.
Mm-hmm.
But the internal level is that cultivation of our feeling sense, of our being able to read and feel into things. I don't even know if that's the right way, but you got what I mean. So it's that right brain activation. And here with Samhita, one of these like underlying teachings is that it's not, on a certain level, it's not this other thing. It's not like there's another I, but it's actually something that is born from the union of those two being balanced.
Yeah.
Which, and everybody knows that when anybody gets too technical, like there's no intuition there at all. But a lot of people forget that when somebody gets too into this, I'm feeling it out, that they're actually losing some intuition as well. You know, we as our culture, we think those people who are feeling it out might be more intuitive, but it's not. That's not the teaching from the Vedic paradigm.
They're
getting in the feelings, mm-hmm. and there's all kinds of biases that are going to mm-hmm. come up, and mm-hmm. and if we follow the rules of Ganita, we are keeping ourselves in check.
Mm-hmm.
So that third eye is that balance. It's that place that's perfectly in between the left and the right hemispheres. It's the consciousness, it's the way of seeing the world that's coming from a balanced place. All right, the last one of the last sentences on page 40 of this version. Life becomes a teacher. Life speaks to one who understands it and reveals that there are no secrets from an awake and aware universe. So with that Samhita, with that opening of the third eye, that awareness, everything can be read. Everything, like there's nothing that can happen around us. Sometimes people say, oh, this happened, what's it mean? If we want to, we can make meaning to everything. And at the same time, sometimes people are looking for meaning in everything and you want to tell them, oh, it means nothing, just so they kind of relax a little bit. But we can interpret everything. And I'll talk about that. There's omens over here. We'll talk about that in omens. All right. Good. So now we go on to the sadangas of Jyotish. So we had the angas of the Vedas. We had the Veda angas before, the limbs of the Vedas. How the Vedas, what were the things that the Vedas worked through? Now we go into what are the limbs, what are the, you know, and our hands, our arms, what do they do for us? What do our legs do for us? Our legs get us around. Our hands allow us to do things. So when they call these things angas, they are what the science works through. It's the means that the science is productive. First one is Gola. Gola now is coming. So Ganita is coming into Gola, and here it's, we're using the same term Ganita, but as a anga instead of a skanda. Gola means just astronomy. So it means going out, and your first exercise in chapter 1 was a Gola exercise. I said, go out and calculate when the moon is going to rise. And so you were starting to practice Gola. You were saying, okay, the moon is going to rise at, let's see, what is the moon phase right now? That we're getting towards new moon. So the moon is going to rise at what time?
Close to midnight.
Uh-huh. I think we're a little bit past that though.
Past?
We're past. Nope, because it's next week. You're right. Right around midnight. Good. So that's an exercise in Gola. That's being aware of the stars, learning the stars, learning the position of them, learning where the planets are, watching them, understanding their movements. Pretty simple. One of the key things I want to mention in this section is there's a concept called pratyaksha. And pratyaksha means I saw it with my own eye. Now, we talked about the mimamsa and the nyaya last class. And in the realm of nyaya, there's things called what is valid knowledge? What can I use as valid knowledge? And it says we can use, and if you look back on page 38, valid knowledge is called pramana. And we have pratyaksha, which is perception. I see it with my own eyes. Anumana. Anu meaning before, mana mind. It means I infer. Well, if the last three people that jumped in that river were eaten by crocodiles, I assume that the next person that gets in that river is going to be eaten by crocodiles. So we know something by inference. We don't need to throw one more person in the river, have them eaten by crocodiles, to say, well, maybe the next person will get eaten by crocodiles too. So by inference. And then we have by comparison. And I'm not going to go into all these. But the fourth one here is shabda. And shabda means by the word. Sometimes people, they question this one. And not all systems accept shabda. But shabda basically means that if a group of scientists say that, you know, some level of voltage of electricity will kill somebody, we can trust that if they did all the research, that that's probably the voltage that will kill somebody. If somebody says this amount of this drug is going to give an overdose, we don't need to, you know, we don't need to try it out. We don't need to see it with our own eyes. We can trust that person, they're a specialist in that area, and if they say that amount kills somebody, then they're valid reference. So sabda is valid reference. But so pratyaksha is the most important one with gola. Gola means I should be able to see it with my own eyes. Someone shouldn't be able to just say the moon rises at 12 o'clock. I should be able to go outside and at 12 o'clock see the moon rise.
Why isn't there a word for, maybe because this is astronomy, okay?
Yeah.
I was going to say, why isn't there a word for experiencing it oneself?
Pratyaksha is experiencing it. It's seeing it with your own eye. Now, some people take this concept of pratyaksha and they interpret it as unaided eye, meaning that I see it with my eye and my eye alone. And so they say that they don't use Uranus, Pluto, and Neptune because I can't see it with my eye alone. I need a telescope to see it. And so they say, because I need a telescope, we won't use it in Vedic astrology because I don't see it. Now, I disagree with that argument because the concept is, you know, if we really look at the essence of pratyaksha, it means I saw it happen. I was listening to a debate the other day. The Tibetan Buddhists, they believe that when certain people die and turn into rainbows, that the only thing left of their body is their nails and their hair. Like their body will disappear, turn into a rainbow, and just their hair and nail is left. And the guy was talking and he said, you know, I went around and I asked all these lamas, I said, have you ever seen it happen? And they're like, no, but I have a friend that saw it happen. Like he couldn't find anybody that actually saw it happen. So this is a case where, well, you know, are we going to take shabda here? Or, you know, can we find at least one person that has pratyaksha, some person that saw it with their own eye? Now, so the concept behind pratyaksha is I'm not believing someone else. I'm seeing it myself. So I can say, yes, this is like that. Without a doubt, I saw it.
Or experience it too, same. Yeah.
Now, if I take a telescope to see Neptune, it's really there. It's not like the telescope is someone else's opinion. So I don't believe in the concept of translating pratyaksha as unaided eye. It means I've seen it with my own eyes. So you'll see that argument where a lot of people don't use Uranus, Pluto, and Neptune because they say you can't see it with an unaided eye. I disagree. And when we do, I guess we're going to do planets a little bit later, so I'll talk about it now. There's other reasons why the classical Vedic astrology doesn't use Uranus and Pluto and Neptune. And that's basically because the system was made with 9 archetypes. And after 9, we get 10, which is 1 and 0. So we've changed and we've entered another system. So any other planet, any other point becomes a becomes some energetic that's already present within the first 9. Let's see. So we're going to approach it more from that direction. And for classical, traditional Vedic astrology, we don't use Uranus, Pluto, and Neptune. In what they call Neo-Vedic astrology, you can use Uranus and Pluto and Neptune. I'm not going to stop anybody from using them. But the important thing is just to understand why the classical system does not use them, and that if we do use them, we are Neo-Vedic. We are not classical anymore. And just to differentiate. All right, so that's Gola.
Do you ever look at those planets?
I have been... and I was for a while, and I stopped, and I recently just started again using them in the Navamsha. That way I can, because if they're going to give effects there, I should be able to see it really clear. I'm really good with the Navamsha, so, and my,
You have been kicked.
Oh.
Yeah.
There are 7 members in this conference.
All right, I'm in the middle now. I like that. So let's see, where were we? So I've been testing them, but there was a famous Vedic astrologer named Narendra Desai, and he used them. He's in the Vedic world. He is considered the main teacher of Uranus, Pluto, and Neptune. And everybody in India uses the names that he gave them, which is Varuna, Varuna, Yama, Pluto becomes Yama, Uranus becomes Pluto, and I'm forgetting what the other one is right now. But like this. So they have their Vedic names, and he was the main teacher of that. But I don't overly... I keep my eye on them, but I don't use them. All right. So Ganita here as a sadanga just means math. And mathematics becomes important. And you'll see when we do the dashas, we're going to calculate them by hand. When we do... all the dashas, I make sure that everybody in book 1 and book 2, that they're all calculated by hand, so that we have that Ganita concept happening in our mind. Making somebody learn how to calculate a chart by hand, I don't make people do that. But I think it's a really, really good thing to do. So if you have spare time and want to learn how to calculate a chart by hand, I recommend it highly. I started doing astrology before there was all kinds of programs to calculate it. So I used to go and have all the books, and I used to calculate. I calculated my first few hundred charts by hand, did all the dashas by hand, and it served me well because I understand how the moon moves, I understand how fast the moon moves and the planets, and all of that by having calculated so many charts by hand. But that's the Ganita realm. Now, traditionally, you learned Ganita first. So if you guys wanted to study with me, you'd have to come. And if I had, you know, a few, however many people I had for the week, you would calculate their charts for me and all their dashas. And maybe after a few years, if you were doing good, I would start telling you what it meant. That's the traditional way to learn. But that doesn't work in America. So... sure. And these days we have computers that calculate it way better than you would on your own. Because I'll tell you, every three charts, I did some wrong calculation, and then everything went whack and had to go back and do it twice. So, all right. Number three is Jataka. And Jataka means, here, Jataka, Jata means to be born. And Ka is like ER. So it means born-er. So we're the borners. We all were born. We all got born. So we're borning. We're birthing. We're all the birthers. So that's literally what it means. So it's talking about, it's reading about your birth. So the chart is the moment of one's birth, and that's what their whole reality is like. So we can literally name somebody the person who was born on this moment. Jataka, and we interpret their whole life. Prashna. So prashna literally means a question. And so the way prashna works is, and prashna becomes very important if we have somebody who doesn't have a birth time. And I occasionally get somebody born in Africa or some out of the way place. And I mean, I once had a guy from Africa, he didn't even know the year he was born. Mm-hmm. Didn't even know the year. When he came to the States, they just made up a birthday for him because there was no birthday. And they just were like, okay, well, let's say about, you know, maybe January 1980. Sure, that sounds good, right? Like, they just made it up. So somebody like that, we have to use prashna for them because we don't have a birth chart. Now, prashna is also used for very little detailed stuff. And let me go deeper into what prashna is first. So prashna is when somebody asks a question. Why did they ask that question now? Why do you start worrying about, you know, you start going, oh, I want to go back to school. I want to go back to school. Should I go back to school? Should I not go back to school? Should I just invest in my business, or should I go back to school, or should I go down to Mexico and study with it, or should I, you know? And so this question comes up, and that question wasn't there last month, but all of a sudden it came up, and it's like, I need to know the answer to this. So the moment the person comes to the astrologer, you see, because once you start knowing this knowledge, people are going to smell it. Like a bee smells a flower, and they're going to come to you and they're going to say, I got this question. I know you got answers. And they're going to say that question at a certain moment. And the moment they say that question, it's because the sky has the answer. And so I look at the chart for the sky at that moment, and I give them the answer based upon that moment. The one of the big stories I tell with this prashna is, I had this one client, he wanted to invest in it. His friend said, oh, it's this big deal, it's this, you know, invest everything, it's gonna go so big. And I did a prashna had the Ketu in the Lagna. Ketu in the Lagna means there's a mistake. Yes. Means there's a mistake. That's what it means. Straight there. Means a mistake. I said, don't do it. He said, oh, but they're guaranteed it's going to go big. And he put all of his money into it. Bam. Gone. So this is what prashna can be used for. It can be used, yeah. So, all right. Muhurta. Muhurta is, it gets translated as electional astrology. It literally means a moment. And so basically, if the moment of your birth can tell so much about you, then the moment you get married can tell so much about your marriage. The moment you start a business can tell so much about your business. The moment you move into a house will tell so much about your life in that house. So that moment we pick, we say, well, if the moment this thing starts determines its nature, then let me find a time that has a really good energy. If I'm going to start a business, let me find a time that's very prosperous and I start a business then. If I'm going to get married, let me find a time that shows is going to be juicy and loving and caring, and let me get married at that moment. So like this, we use Muhurta to pick a good time. Then we have Namita, which is omens, the ability to read life. And I was going to tell a story about omens, and I was in the other section. And I was, oh, I'll wait till we do Namita. Oh, what was that omen? Omens. So that's what I was going to. So omens, omens matter at the moment something begins. So let's say you're thinking, wow, should I study astrology with Freedom and all these people that are taking this class, or maybe I should focus on something else? And halfway through the class, a window breaks. That's not an omen. If you're about to, you're getting ready, you're signing in, you're like, wow, I wonder if I should be taking this class. You sign in, it opens up, and then the window breaks. That's an omen that it might not be the best class. If you sign on, you're about to start the class, and somebody sends you a text and says, oh, my boyfriend just asked me to marry him, then it's going to be a really good class for you. If that text came, you know, maybe 3/4 of the way through the class, then it doesn't matter. It's not an omen anymore. The omens matter at the moment we're beginning something. Just like the chart. That moment that we begin, you're about to move into a new home, you can watch the omens. What's the news? What's going on? What's happening? And that's all giving you information for what's about to happen. All right. Namita in that realm. Oh, yeah, we're good. All right. Breath comes into there. Sound. Everything. Everything that you can perceive comes into Namita. All right. Any questions before we go into karma? Yeah, what was your namita? At the puja to move into your house? Mm-hmm. What was the namita?
Well, some friends randomly showed up.
Uh-huh.
Like demanding money.
Oof.
And we didn't know that they were coming. I thought maybe someone had told them that we were doing this because I was inviting people.
Yeah.
And they just showed up and they had to wait through the whole thing, you know, because we were so busy.
Uh-huh.
And they were leaving the next day for, you know, another country. But it was, that was kind of intense.
That omen of saying, give me.
Yeah, it was very, their energy was very, they had a small kid, and it was very, like, needy. And afterwards, you know, Mateo, my partner, and the man got into a very heated argument sitting right by the fire was still burning from the puja. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of, and then, you know, the guy, I kept asking him to not walk on the, Virji had made these nice, you know, what are they called in the
designs with
the
rice.
Designs, yeah.
The rangoli. With the coconut and the rice.
With the rice, and they make like the, anyways. So I kept having to ask him to not step on these, you know, and he kept walking, stepped right over the little, right. You know, the fire that had the what's it called?
The duni.
The duni.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He kept stepping right over that, and I was just like, it felt, to me, it was very, I felt like very protective.
Mm-hmm.
Like I've had this very strong energy of like,
violent.
Yeah, I felt kind of violated.
So
yeah.
In that means that there's, and we could say that that's a Saturn-Mars dosha showing up, you know? So Saturn, give me, and the aggressiveness, Mars. So it means that in the future, you're going to have to look at the properties, Vastu, and do something to Shanti, that energy. And since they were demanding money, you want to look at the financial direction and make sure that the Vastu in that realm is settled.
Mm.
And you want to make sure that the relationship zone, also if there's fighting, is settled.
Mm.
So that's giving us the omen.
Yeah.
And showing us what the land needs to be healthy.
Mm.
So in that same way, you know, my first marriage, in India they give a necklace to get married instead of a ring, and on the walk to get married I was pickpocketed and that was stolen.
The Mangala Sutra.
The Mangala Sutra was stolen.
Oh, wow.
And so
wow.
And so we had to buy like a cheap version last minute.
Wow.
And so
that's
what
a pretty, big
pretty big omen,
omen
that the marriage wasn't gonna
that's
work. But at that moment the whole family was there and everything, the priests were arranged, it was the dinners, the food, what do you do? Yeah, you know, but but the omen was clear. The omen was clear that this is not going to work. So the omens are always clear. Now can we do whatever remedy is needed to, or is the remedy just, you know, is the Namita just indicating what's going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Karma. And so as when we look at the Vedic astrological chart, it is a map of karma. I'll say it again. It is a map of karma. The chart's a map of karma. So, where does karma live? In us. Anybody have any clues? Where does karma live inside of us?
In our causal body?
In our causal body, exactly. So the karmas live inside of our causal body. And so that the astrological chart is a map of what's going on in our causal body. And that causal body karmas, that's what they are. Just like the physical body has a heart and it has intestines and it has a mouth and eyes. That's the components of the physical body. When we look at the components of the mental body has a memory, it has feelings, it has an intellect, it has a self-maker, what is translated as ego. Those are the organs of the mental body. When we go to the causal body has the archetypal planets and the archetypes that they make and the karmas from various lives stored. Those are the organs, the planets you could call the organs of the causal body. So those karmas that live in our causal body are seen in the sky at the moment of our birth.
Is there the organs of the causal body, if that's all?
And it's an analogy. It's an analogy. We don't want to use
no
a direct.
There's no translation. Okay.
It's not a direct translation, but...
Right.
Like the body has organs, like the mental body has these functions,
mm-hmm.
the causal body has the karmas
mm-hmm.
that are ruled by the planets. It's an analogy. Because otherwise we need the metaphor to understand the causal body. So as an astrologer, you are a reader of karma and a doctor of karma. A doctor of karma. and the term used in Sanskrit is called Daivya Chikitsa. Daivya Chikitsa means the treatment, therapy, treating of your fate, of your destiny, of the karmas that are happening.
Daivya, huh?
Daivya.
I think that's where my name comes from.
D-A-I-V-Y-A.
I think that's mm-hmm. where the root of it. Daivya.
Uh-huh.
Daivya.
Say again, Daivya.
Daivya? It means, it can be translated as fate or destiny. Basically, it's what we're reading in the astrological chart, is someone's Daivya.
But you said it was another word.
Daivya Chikitsa. C-H-I.
I-T-S-A.
K-I-T-S-A.
It means treatment.
It just means treatment. Like yoga chikitsa means to treat somebody with yoga. Yeah. So we are doing Daivya Chikitsa. And if we look in Charaka Samhita and these Ayurvedic texts, they here and there sprinkle in a concept of something called Karmaja Vyadi. Karmaja means, ja means born, so it means, Vyadi means disease, so disease, born ja of karma, karma ja vyadi. And one of my favorite verses in Charaka, it says something along the lines of, if you eat the right food and you exercise and you get up at the right times and you live everything, you know, it lists all the things that you have to do right. And it says, and if you do all this, you'll live a very long, healthy life, unless your karma says otherwise. So, and so here we have, you know, it's and we find this regularly throughout. It's very much saying that, you know, this works, except, you know, your karma, that which is born of karma can overpower any action that you do. All right. So of karma, and karma is the law of karma is considered to be that which keeps harmony in the universe. The universe experiences harmony through every cause having an effect, and every effect having a cause, and by the law of that, things have harmony. Nothing happens without a reason. No reason just randomly exists. So anytime somebody says, oh, I can overcome my karma, it's like, it's from a Vedic perspective, it's a demonic statement. Like, literally, it's like, oh, you want to be a demon and just, like, destroy the natural order? You want to just do bad things and not pay the consequences? It's, you know, so karma is not something that is hurting you. It's not something that's out to get you. It's just what we do, we experience the effects of. And that becomes fair. So karma's fair. Whatever's happening to somebody, whatever their karma is, if they're suffering or happy, it's all fair. It's a completely fair and just system. So why would we want to overcome fair? Why would we want to cheat the system?
It's easier.
our goal is not to overcome the karma, but our goal is to work with the karma. If we have a lesson that we need to learn, well, we could be poor for 10 years and have poverty and barely be able to pay our bills. Or we could say, hey, let me find another way to learn about this. I'm sorry I did whatever I did. Let me give some donation and help those people I took money from. Let me help them out. And you know, so thereby I'm getting that those people are suffering and what I did was wrong. Okay, now I don't have to experience it myself. So our goal is to learn. So we don't want to just not care about karma or overcome our karma. We want to work with karma, because it's the law. It's the natural law. It's dharma. It's the harmony of the universe, and we want to be in harmony with it. We don't want to fight it. So our goal is not to fight karma. Our goal is it's like a ship on the sea. Okay, big waves coming. How do we, you know, navigate the ship so that we can get over this wave in a way that the boat we stay as dry as possible. All right, four types of karma. Sanchita karmas, everything. Parabdha karma, those are the karmas that we experience in this life, that we see in the chart. Kriyamana karmas, they're the ones that we're doing now. So let's see, what was the last donation I made? My last donation was made to a reporter. Somebody who makes news at Standing Rock, for them to be over there to be able to make the news, and, you know, because who else is paying for news coming from Standing Rock? So by me supporting that reporter, which is just a person with a video camera, I'm creating a certain karma. And today, yeah, everything I said to my clients is creating a certain karma. My meditation is creating a certain karma. So kriyamana is the things I'm doing right now. And then agama karma means that agama karma is my desires. So And I've kind of like, the desire is slowly burning out. But I used to have this big, strong desire that I figure since I'm going to live 88 years, that on my 80th birthday, I'll stop doing Jyotish and just start learning the Veena. And I'll just spend the last 8 years of my life studying Veena. That way, when I get reborn, I'll be reborn into a family that plays the Veena. And I'll be able to learn from a little kid how to play the Veena. And just so you know, I'm terrible at playing music. I have a hard time playing my tambora. Okay? I can't even tune my tambora. I need somebody to tune it for me. So maybe at least when I'm 80, I'll be able to learn how to tune it. But so this is agama. I'm desiring to learn something, and that strong desire in me is going to create a situation in my next life that's going to make that happen. And, you know, often people in poor countries, they desire to be rich. So then they get born in America, they get to be rich, and then they, you know, they don't care about anything. And then they get born back in some other country where so our desires, they determine where we're showing up and what's happening in the future. Sanchita karmas. Sanchita is the everything, every life I've ever lived. There's this big old bank that's all stored. And the Western term they use is the Akashic Records. I don't know if I want to use the term Akashic Records. It's not a Vedic term. But it comes from a Vedic concept. The Akashic Records is a theosophical concept that was a translation of a concept of the eternal storehouse of Sanchita Karmas. We don't read Sanchita Karmas. If you want to know about Sanchita Karmas, you go to a psychic. And that psychic will say, in your last life, you were the queen of Egypt. And when you were the queen of Egypt, you fell in love with somebody from, yeah, whatever, you know, like, and so that's a psychic's job. And I once had a psychic, he told me, he said, he's saying I was this, I was that, I was this, and it was all sounding right. And then he goes, and in a past life, you were a disciple of Jesus. And at that point, I was like, okay, this guy's full of it now. but I was like, if I was a disciple of Jesus, I think I'd be a little more Christian oriented at this point. But
maybe not, because that's fulfilled. And then you're like, oh, well, I've got this Christian thing. Now what? What do I desire to check out next? Yeah.
He was good on everything else, but that one was a little. But so that's the Sanchita Karmas. We don't read Sanchita Karmas. If somebody wants to know that, you say, you know, I know this psychic down over around the corner, and she's pretty good. I use this one psychic when I have those kind of things that are needed, and I have a good one that I recommend. But you got to find somebody good that you recommend that you work with. But make sure that people don't think you're a psychic, because, and you could do psychic work too, but that's, you know, Jyotish is not about being a psychic. Prarabdha karmas, that's what we read in the birth chart. When we look at the birth chart, we're reading the Prarabdha karmas. And I think Robert Swoboda, he wrote a whole book where he just goes on and on and on about Prarabdha karmas. Anybody know which one that was? One of his books, he goes on and on and on about Prarabdha.
We can even read, I know that the stars on the chart are the past life karmas that we're reading, but we can also, infer or use Hora to interpret, like, also the person's, what the desires may be or what they may be doing as well from the chart. We can look at, we can see that too.
We'll have a general understanding of what the Kriyamana and Agama are, but it'll be a general. When we want to know about the Kriyamana, then we do Prashna.
Oh, yeah?
What the person is doing now.
All right.
Because that birth chart is indicating the Prarabdha. It's indicating all the karma that they had before and the tendencies that they're going to have.
Right.
But just because you have a tendency to write doesn't mean that life gave you the situation that allows you to be a great writer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we use the Prashna And, you know, when you ask, should I go to school right now or should I go to Mexico and study with this or that, I'm doing a prashna because there's what you, and I'm comparing that with your birth chart.
Mm.
Because what is happening now? What is the actions that are best now? And the prashna is going to give me that idea. And then for the agama karma, the agama, what they're desiring, we do the muhurta. Muhurta is all, what we're creating, you know, you're getting married, you want it to be a good marriage. So whatever, what is the wants and needs that we want in that marriage, we put into that muhurta to create a future desire, a desirable outcome. Now, there's a chart not mentioned here, and that's called the Punya Chakra. And I have, if you look at my blog, and the blog you can get to through the bottom of my personal website, and it lists the last four articles, but on there I have an article on BKS Iyengar. And when he died, they had the moment that he died, and so I was able to put that into the computer, look at the chart at the moment he died.
Mm-hmm.
And I give the basic rules for Punya Chakra there. And the reason I used his chart is because, you see, the birth chart's what you're coming into this life with, the Punya Chakra, that shows what you did with what you have.
Mm-hmm.
Were you a good person in this life? When you had the chance, like, okay, so maybe you have a tendency to lie, do you just, like, lie? Or do you work really hard to, like, try and be honest? So what do you do with your tendencies that you were born with? It shows up in the death chart.
The moment you die, you see your punya.
You see your punya. You see your the marriage. Good and bad you've done.
It doesn't show where you're going. It
100% will show where you're going, how long you'll be in the bardos, when you'll reincarnate, where you're going to reincarnate. Mm-hmm. It's completely, this is what's used to find tokus.
Did you look at...
We don't have his exact time.
It has to be exact. That's an exhalation.
We want the exact time. Okay, exact. Yeah. So if we only have like a 3-4 hour gap, it's not good enough. Because it can be, you know, one of many lagnas there. When we have somebody like Gandhi, JFK,
right, we know.
People like that, we know the exact moment they died.
Mm.
Like, we can look at Gandhi's chart and we can see, okay, Gandhi had some issues over here and, you know, he was a great saint, but he's coming back to deal with those, you know, those issues.
Mm-hmm.
And most charts you look at, you can see, okay, this is the secret that the person had and they're coming back to have to deal with. When we look at Iyengar's chart, I was just I'm so impressed.
Really?
I was so impressed, I wrote an article on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the most beautiful Punya chart I've ever seen. Only one that ever compared to it was Hadakan Babaji, his priest. I saw his priest's Punya Chakra, and that one was pretty good. But that one showed that the priest would reincarnate. The seventh lord had gone to the ninth, so it showed that the priest would reincarnate because of the guru's order. In order to serve the guru more, he would reincarnate. But Iyengar has every single moksha combination possible. So that's the Punya Chakra. I was with my dad when he passed, so I was able to look at his Punya Chakra as well, which I wouldn't advise looking at your parents' Punya Chakra unless you have a lot of dispassion, because you'll see all the bad things they did in their life.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a pretty good one. All right, so three intensities of karma. So we have these four types of karma, the sanchitta, the prarabdha, kriyamana, and agama. And we have the four different ways to look at that, right? Then we have the three intensities of karma. And intensities and types, I'm making those terms up just to differentiate. But the intensities, we're looking at dridda, dridda adridda, and adridda. Dridda. So the dridda means fixed. It's gonna happen without a doubt. It's, you see it in the chart, and we'll learn how to see the difference between the three. So if there's an indication that that's there, there's no changing it. Person has to learn how to deal with it. They have to learn how to compensate or to find a way to include that karma. Looked at a chart once, woman had dridda karma to not have children. So, you know, she and I saw it, I looked, I mentioned it, she got all depressed. How dare you tell me I can't have kids? I'm like, hey, 15 years later, she's like, you know, you were right. I don't want kids. I'm so happy I don't have kids. She's a musician, travels all over the world. So we have, you know, fixed karma. Then we have dridda adrida. It means fixed, not fixed. So it's called medium intensity. And fixed, not fixed, it means that it's a pretty strong karma. But if we do pujas and mantras and donation, and you know, we can do a lot of work and service and a lot of stuff to do interchange, and then we can create a difference. So if the woman had dridda adrida karma to not have a kid, with the right work, maybe adopting a child, doing some service work and some mantras, she would be able to burn the karma that was blocking it and be able to have her own children. Then we have adrida karma. And adrida, it means it's a general karma. Maybe it'll happen, you know. If you don't do something different and things just continue down that path, it's what's going to happen. But if you say, oh my gosh, if I just continue going down this path, I'm going to end up broke when I get old. So let me find a financial advisor to help me figure out my finances, because I completely don't understand finances. And so that adrida karma to be poor when they're old, can with a financial advisor, they can make a simple choice and it changes the karma. So we have three intensities: dridda, dridda adrida, and adrida. So fixed, medium, and then not fixed. And so occasionally people start, they have these debates. Oh, I don't believe in karma. I don't believe that this, you know, and then there's people that they say they overly believe in karma, and how much can you change, and how much is free will? And so what we see from this intensities is that there's different levels, different things have different levels of karma, and it's all different for all of us. Some of us have fixed karma in the realm of children. Some of us have fixed karma in the realm of our education. Some of us have fixed karma in cars. You know, every car we have breaks down or gets crashed into. Or every, you know, or the person gets pregnant at 20 and then somehow they have three more kids after that. And did they, you know, where the fixed karma to have kids? So when you start arguing free will and versus karma, it's really an oversimplistic kind of discussion, because there's just these different densities, there's different levels, there's, you know, certain areas have more free will and certain areas have more things that we are destined to experience. All right. Any questions with that?
In the book, you talk about fixed signs showing dridda karma, dual showing dridda adrida, and
More so than others. Uh-huh. There's more fixed karma in fixed signs. Okay. Fixed signs, the thing is, they want it to happen. You know, it's mm-hmm. not moving. Where a movable sign, it's just changing, it's easily changing, it's more flexible, moving around. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So, but then there's other significations, which when we do a determination of house strengths, that's where we really bring in the density of karma.
Okay.
We're looking at the Lord, the house, and the sign Lord. So we have three factors there.
Mm-hmm.
They can all align or can all be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. All right. So I have with me a few different texts. And these are just the most recent texts that I was digging around. And there's... actually, let me make sure there's no more questions on karma. This is more karma, though, but just on our three densities and four types. All right. So, and I'm just going to read the, and as I said, the reason I'm reading these is because I recently did a lot of research with this text, and so it's the text that's most at the tip of my tongue. Maybe it's the written, I don't know. It's the text that's most fresh with, that I've been digging in at the moment. And there's actually a video, Sapta Rishis, I did a 2-hour video for them. If you look at my Facebook page, I gave a link there where you can look at the Sapta Rishi page. And I gave a 2-hour lecture on the material that I was working on from this text. And Laurel actually got to be in the office while I was giving that little lecture. So from that, I'm gonna read something very different that I didn't talk about in that class, but from the same text. And so this is a text from the 8th century by Abhinavagupta. And so I'm just gonna read this so that we can see where these, so that the concepts of karma, they show up in multiple Vedic, Puranic, and Tantric texts, and yogic texts as well, that we see these little stories and statements that are giving us insight into the laws of karma. And on a certain level, they're kind of like, almost like if you said, I was having urinary problems and they realized that my kidney had a mouth, wasn't functioning properly. So somebody that's never studied biology would be like, oh my gosh, the urine is connected to the kidney? Why are they talking about urine and urinary tract and kidney? You know what I mean? We assume, we know that the kidney is extracting excess water out of the blood to put into the bladder. But somebody who wasn't trained in biology, they gotta take that and they have to reverse engineer. They gotta be like, okay, so they're mentioning urine and they're mentioning the kidney, so the kidney must have some connection with urine and the water in the system. And so we reverse engineer to kind of put the story together. And so we do a lot of that in the Vedic, Tantric, Puranic, and yogic texts, where we have these little statements about karma, and we reverse engineer to get like, oh, this is what these people believed. So here in this section, it's chapter 6 of a text by Abhinavagupta, chapter 6 of Tantra Loka, 8th century, and he's talking about the prana. And he's saying that the prana, this body is moving because of prana. I'm moving because of prana. And he says the activity of the prana lays hold of the body in 5 ways. And it is because of this that the body appears full of consciousness. That the body's alive and moving because there's prana in it. And so he makes that statement. And then he says, thus, fools who observe the activity of the body, luminous with consciousness. It means there's prana here. It's like filled with prana and luminous with consciousness. And luminous with consciousness and the one with activity of the vitalizing breath. And here it's an interesting term. And I'm sorry if I go into linguistics, but the word is pranana. So it's prana, na. So if we put ing on prana, so the body is prana-ing. The body's luminous with consciousness and it's prana-ing. It's breathing, it's you know, what is the prana? It's the if we turn prana into a verb. So the body is full of consciousness and it's filled with vitality. They think nothing apart, the fools that look at the body, seeing the prana and the consciousness in it, but think that nothing apart from the body exists. So he's saying that there's fools out there. So first he says, you know, the body, it's prana that's moving this entire body. And then he says, there's fools out there that think that there's nothing except this material body, that they don't believe in prana. And he says, basing themselves on this conception, peculiar to perceivers of low status, it is elevated by materialists. And the word for materialists is called charvaka, who believe that they perceive reality to the dignity of a system. And so basically he's saying that these materialists, these people, they see only the body and they think, oh, the heart makes the blood move. And the brain is where thought happens. He says, and they're total materialists who don't believe in any prana. He said, you know, they have such ego. They hold their system to be so dignity, with such dignity and pomp. So he's, you know, we think that the allopathic medical system that considers itself the best and ignores spirituality and prana and consciousness, we kind of think that that's a new thing. But in the 8th century, he's talking about these materialists who don't believe in prana. And he says, if this conception that we're just this material body without prana or consciousness, if this conception takes a firm and persistent hold of them, when the body comes to an end, they fall asleep until such mental impressions are exhausted. So I'm going to reverse engineer a little bit for you. And the basic concept is that whatever you believe happens when you die, that's what you experience. Because basically when you die, it's like you enter the dream world. So if you believe in Jesus and that you're going to go hang out with Jesus when you die and in your dream, you're like, oh, okay, I'm dead. Like, where's Jesus? And you look around and just like a dream can manifest Jesus, you're like, ah, there's Jesus. I'm here with, you know, I've done it. If you're Shaivite and you believe that you're going to go sit on Kailash with Shiva, you know, and you get and you're like, ah, there's the mountain, you know, outside of the tunnel. And so it's like a dream world. All the images come based upon what you believe. So these people who believe that we're just material and that there's nothing else, when they die, it's like they go into a deep sleep. And they stay in that deep sleep until all their materialistic impressions pan themselves out. So where the average person might, you know, they have this beautiful experience and then they get reincarnated in a month or two. Some of these atheists, you know, it might be a few years and they're just like in this dark emptiness. And then at some point, and he says, when this impression comes to an end, and these mental impressions, these mental beliefs, when they come to an end, another impression, which has not come to an end, is for some reason or another awakened and gives rise to diverse results. And I'm going to read. And so he says that, you know, okay, so they were complete materialists. And he says it a little bit more in the next verse. But somewhere in there, they always doubt it. They're like, well, maybe there is prana. Maybe there is something more. And so they're in this deep sleep where there's nothing. And then all of a sudden that thought that, well, maybe what if there is Jesus? And then all of a sudden they're like, wow, there's Jesus. Okay. And then they come up and new impressions get created. So and then Abhinavagupta says the latent impressions, and the term is vasana, these latent desires or impressions out of which this materialistic atheism, which the term is Gnostica, is born, is said to be the most sinful of all. So, and I think I talk about this more in level 2. Or do I talk about it in level 1, Ian? Correct me. From the Vedic perspective, you can be whatever religion you want, but the most important thing is to be a believer. In 2 I talk about it? Okay. Be a believer, but don't sit there and say, oh, there's nothing other than this that exists. Because it's the most egotistical thing to think that you're smart enough to say that there's no God, that there's no other world, that there, like, it's the most egotistical, uneducated thing to say. You the world is so beyond this little brain. So
the vasanas are the impressions of the mind?
They're the desires.
The desires.
Yeah, the vasana. Impressions, desires. Samskaras, they're, you know. Samskaras give birth to vasanas.
I see.
The tendencies give, so if you have a tendency to get ice cream every day after every Jyotish class you get ice cream. That's as soon as you get done class, you're gonna be like, oh, I want some ice cream, because that's it's just your tendency.
It's a conditioning.
And the desire is born from that. So he's translating it as impression.
Okay.
But it's you could translate it as desire as well. But so the term is Gnostica. It means an unbeliever. So, like, you could believe that the sun is God, you could believe that Shiva is God, you could believe that Jesus is God, whatever you want to believe, but just believe, because it's your belief that creates reality. But if you say that nothing exists, it's just considered, literally, he's saying it's the most sinful of all. this is, for a number of reasons, because the doubt persists that this view is not well established. So he says that, you know, an atheist, they can never be sure. There's always some doubt hiding in their consciousness. It is only because the state of the previous impression, which is not materialistic, is not so. And so he says, so there's some other impression there. Moreover, because it is weakened by the existence of moral duties and da-da-da-da-da, again. So he's just saying why it's not good and why those things come up. So we see in here there's this karmic theory, and this karmic theory of impressions creating. So our impressions not only create what we experience in this life, but they're also, when we die, literally manifesting the dream world that we enter. All right, so that was chapter 6, and in the same text, and I don't know how much of this I'm going to read. I'm going to read 10 minutes, and then somebody stop me at 7:30 so we can talk. Do 15 minutes for the sun and 15 minutes for the moon. All right. So in chapter 28 of the same text by Abhinavagupta, it's and again, this is a chapter on astrology and festivities. And that chapter 6 is a chapter on astrology. So he talks about death and karma in the two chapters that have to do with astrology. The first appearance of life, death, and decay of the body. We will now, by the way, clearly explain the nature of death. And although Shiva is all-pervading, by sealing himself into a contracted state, fashioned out of his own free will, he assumes this or that body under the sway of the flux of karma that bears wonderfully varied consequences. So he's sitting here saying, you know, Shiva limits himself, contracts himself, throws himself into a body, and experiences karma. So it starts by saying that we're all Shiva. that limited itself to experience this great array of the realm of karma. Such is the assumption of an embodied state, namely the initial emergence of the life force from the consciousness blocked in the void that takes place in the body within the womb. The sovereign power to fashion the body in the womb belongs solely to the initial emergence of the life force, which is as yet uncontracted and undifferentiated. Thus it is said that it is the Lord who makes the body and the rest of the psycho physical organism. This assumes the nature of the vital wind, the prana, that circulates within the solid machine of the body, impelled by the self, which is consciousness, as air within the bellows. Thus the fetus awakens like one who was first in a profound deep sleep rises from it. So again, we have this concept that, you know, coming into consciousness is, you know, we're coming out of that sleep, that dream realm. There also the prana, along with the body, gradually becomes stronger, and because of the power of karmic necessity, the vital force assumes the state of the organs of sense that as the contact with consciousness in the channels, the nadis, become more intense. The strength of the vital breath, nourished gradually in this way, the soul in the body, whether it is born from the womb or not, experiences intensely many worldly experiences brought about by its karma. So I'm going to break that down a little bit. So here it's saying that by karmic necessity, by the fact of karma, that the body develops these pranic channels and it develops the senses and all the organs. And they're developing, they're being shaped by the prana, they're being shaped by consciousness, and they're being shaped by our karma. So as we're developing in the womb, it's not just by chance that we got this nose and these eyes and these lips. That, you know, why did you get my daughter? She has her mother's eyes and she has her mother's chin, but she has my nose, my cheeks, my eyebrows, my forehead. So why did she take them from me and the other from her mother? She had some karma related to the sun and the moon that she took from her mom. She had some karma relative to Venus that she took from me. So the different karmas are being taken, and how the body is forming is being guided by our karma in the womb. All right. And let's see, it says whether it is born from the womb or not, which is an interesting statement here. So we can talk about test tube babies if we want there. Experiences intensely the many worldly experiences brought about by its karma. Did you catch all that, Ian, or was it just your video camera? Yeah. It totally, like, completely jives with everything we work on in level two. And I'm not going into that level of that verse, but it totally supports everything that we learn in there with the five senses and, yeah. So let's see. So he says, Shiva, who bears the crescent moon as a jewel in his hair, has said in the scripture called the Garvara that just as after having constructed a house, the householder occupies it, in the same way, the embodied soul occupies the body after he has made it. So the soul is guiding based upon its karma. It's guiding how this body gets constructed and what we look like. And then after it builds the body, it jumps inside. Prior to the embodied condition, he is just a subtle, radiant pulse of consciousness, devoid of qualities of action. When on the principles, senses are fully evident, it is called the differentiated soul. So once the senses begin to exist within the womb, that's where the soul becomes differentiated. It's where the soul becomes manifest in physical time. And he uses the term nishkala this and more is said in the venerable Gavara Tantra. One can read more about this from that text. And that text doesn't exist anymore. So all we have is this little quote there. So then he says, when their karmas, which determined their birth, are exhausted, and the machine of the body has become other than it is, the machine of the vital breath, or the mechanism of the vital breath, falls apart. Thus the body becomes inert like a wall. So the body is being held together by the prana, and it's the karmas that are moving the prana. So he says once the karmas have become exhausted, then the prana stops moving and the body is done. The wise say that the falling apart that takes place in the mechanism of the body is whatever disrupts the body's original constitution. Examples are the reversal of the contraction and expansion that takes place in the configuration of the breath, the deficiencies and excesses of the vata, pitta, and kapha that break up, dry up, and become excessively wet. So he's talking about reasons for death. When the mechanism of the body have fallen apart, consciousness again assumes the nature of the life force within another body, be it one born from a womb or elsewhere. Mm-hmm. There's a lot in that statement there. I don't know if we don't have time to cover that, but...
Because, you know, there's, like, chickens hatch from eggs and stuff.
He's actually talking about... See, he's in the realm where, you know, like, okay, so he's ready to move body, and he's like, okay, there's a young person, not important. I'll just leave this body and jump into that body. And he talks about how to do it, and later in this chapter, actually. He talks about how to withdraw the prana and the senses and then smoothly take them into another body so that you don't have to be reborn. Mm-hmm. And that way you can be transferred with your full awareness.
Simple.
And then you take on... But the karmas are exhausted.
So well, this is when they're not exhausted. This is when you're wanting. This is when the body becomes exhausted.
So you jump into another body, and then you would continue to live out your karmas, or you would take on.
That's an interesting concept. Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You make sure that that transition happens at a good muhurta, right? Mm-hmm. various according to the soul's karma. Oh, look! He says, when the mechanism of the body has fallen apart, consciousness again assumes the nature of the life force within another body, be it one born of a womb or elsewhere. Various according to the soul's karma. This body awakens like one arisen from deep sleep, and as before, in the preceding body, the soul has worldly experiences according to its karma. These phases of creation, persistence, and reabsorption are due to the strength of the soul's karma, and so take place in accord with the dictates of a variety of constraints due to the soul's karma. All right. Okay, so we'll end with this verse right here. It keeps going. There's a whole bunch. We're not going to cover everything. But my concept is really just to show you that, you know, all these rules of karma, and we could pick up some Puranas, and there's verses here. We pick up Mahabharata, and there's stories of, oh, well, this is happening because of my last life, and it tells this whole long story of what happened in his last life, and that's why this is happening now. They have that in these texts. But this is a nice verse to end on. It says, how can the grace, and when he's talking about grace, he's talking about divine grace. Where Shiva says, now I grace you to be enlightened. So he says, how can the grace, which is the intuitive insight of one's own unfolding nature, be dependent on karma and the constraint that it exerts? Let's see. The very life of karma, the constraint, time, is contracted. So how can this serve as the cause of grace, the nature of which is in the destruction of contraction? So it's sitting there saying, so karma is contracting your God nature, limiting you into this little body to work. So how can that be the cause of divine grace to come into your life?
That's a good question.
And so basically, and I'm not going to go and read more, but this starts a whole section where he says, you know, be it the bum on the street, be it the teeny bopper girl in a high school, be it the term that they always use in the Puranic text is even the prostitute. They always say even the prostitute, mm-hmm. divine grace can fall on her at any moment, and she can realize her absolute true nature.
But that would have to be in your karma to do that, or grace is beyond that.
He's saying it's beyond. According to him, he's saying divine grace is beyond. It's beyond karma. That's his statement.
I'm with him.
You can choose whether to believe or not. But he's saying, his basic argument is, if karmas are that which is constricting us, how can it be that which is also liberating us?
Mm-hmm. Because we become aware of our constraints before we didn't even know we were constrained.
He's saying, from his perspective, you just say, Shiva, I'm ready.
I'm ready right here.
Because to him, Shiva is not some person sitting, but mm-hmm. to Abhinavagupta, Shiva is, if you just take a minute to be aware of yourself, of the room around you, of your body in the room, of your breath, and feel, you know, as you're being aware of all this, your awareness is getting slightly bigger. So that awareness, that's Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
So he says to that, you say, Shiva, awareness, basically, I'm ready. And then you wait for awareness to say, all right, let's go, you know, so, all right.
It's interesting, he says, how can this serve as a cause of grace, the nature of which is the destruction of that contraction?
So because that grace destroys your karma, it destroys that which limits you. And it's going to, you know,
but
with
the
that...
body is...
Because karma will guarantee that you're going to be reborn. Mm. And that grace makes it so you're not reborn. It destroys the trap of karma that you're stuck in. So how can karma destroy the trap of karma?
Right. Huh.
That's his statement.
Mm. That's beautiful.
Yes. All right. So, and as I said, texts and texts and texts, and you see all the books behind me, and there's, you know, every other one I can find a little something on karma in. But this one is quite direct. All right. Let's see. Pooja asked a question, and she said, "Guru Kripa, is there anything like free will?" So free will, it's a big debate. Level two, if you take level two, we can go into Ichha Shakti and desire and free will on that level. Once, you know, really free will versus fate, it gets to be, you know, once you start reading a chart and reading charts and seeing how it's interacting, then we can have a talk on free will. and I just say that because people that don't read charts have a very different concept of free will and destiny than people who can sit down and say, you're going to get married in 4 years. And then in 4 years, the person gets married. But and like, at that point, you know, yeah.
Free will and fate could be like when we were doing my chart and we were seeing astrology or psychology, right? So even though the karma is there, mm-hmm. the free will is in the choice of being able to choose which medium to...
It's going
to
come out in.
Get there. So yeah. You still have the free will even in the destiny.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's one way to look at it. But there's multiple ways.
Sure, of course.
All right.
Planets.
So our goal now is, and so you've done the Graha chapter with Ian. I'm not going to be here next week. It's going to be Ian, and Ian is going to start the house chapter. Or no, the Rashi chapter next week. And I just said house, and I'm going to give the reason why Rashi's come before houses. When we pick up any classic text behind me, in all classic texts, Rashi's come before houses. And I'm just for time's sake, I'm going to leave it at that. And so I, in this teaching, we go in the traditional format, which is we learn the Rashi's, then we learn the houses. Rashi's are more archetypal states of being. We'll leave it. There's no way to summarize it. All right. So Ian is going to start that next week with you. Let's see. Before I do grahas, what was that? The homework was to read each of these planets each day. And it was to listen to the end of chapter two so that you were familiar with those types of karma. And there was a third one, right?
Practicing Sanskrit.
Oh, and practicing your Sanskrit. Good. All right. So we'll throw practicing Sanskrit again on that list. And make sure that, you know, that this reading the planets every morning, if you've been reading me, good. Now maybe get a different one or two other books out there. Go online. Be careful what you read, but just read some other people's concepts of the planets. For you two, I expect you to be tapping into some of these classics and reading the planets to really know Varahamihira's concept of sun. But so each day, read a little bit about each planet so that you can be just refreshing yourself. And if you start the day reading about the planet, you're going to be thinking about that planet slightly all day. And it can become a deeper connection inside of you. So archetypal. And I keep using the term archetypal because it's the best thing in the English language. But how Carl Jung and James Hillman have been using archetypes, which is basically the Western psychological community uses the term archetype, to me is very limited. And it's limited in that it focuses straight on the psychology. The archetype is only translated psychologically. Where for us, the archetype is more like Plato's archetype, where it's both something in the astral realm, it's something in the causal realm, it's something that shows up physically, it's something that shows up psychologically, it's something that shows up in our families. The archetypes to us are, it's a mandala. So when we look at these mandalas, You can see sometimes a triangular shape in the middle, and then there's a row of petals, and then another row of petals, and then maybe something else. If we look at the Kala Chakra, there's like so many different levels. And directly, if we talk about the Kala Chakra, that outer level is the physical body. The next level is the mental body. Then the inner middle is the causal body, and then we have Kala Chakra with Vishvamata in the middle. So, and then there's different deities on each side, and all those deities, they're all representing these different levels of that thing in the middle's manifestation. So as an archetype, we're seeing it manifest on all levels. And let's take the sun first. So the sun as an archetype represents our father. It represents the president or the king. It represents our spine. It represents psychologically our confidence. What other level can we go?
The soul.
It represents, on a health level, it represents vitality. On a spiritual level, it represents the soul. Mm-hmm. What's another domain of life? In literature, it represents self-inquiry, knowledge that makes you look at your interior self. So we see it manifesting on different levels. Where now from a Western archetypal perspective, it's all just about, you know, your sense of self and your confidence. They stop there. Where we throw it into the body, we throw it into the sciences, we throw it into careers. There's no realm that is not covered by these archetypes. Everything in the universe can fit into the nine planets. Can I say that again? Everything in the universe can fit into the nine planets. It all can into that planet. So, so this planet, it's a frequency. It's a feeling, it's a note, it's a type of energy. And it's something that we want to know, both rationally, as well as not unrationally, not non-rationally, but super rationally. Mm-hmm. We want to have a higher rationale about it. We want to be able to when I'm done tonight, whatever I say, if I say something, you could either say sun or moon. Sun or moon. You could pick which planet that whatever I say fits into, even if I've never said it before. And I always give the story of there was this one computer programmer, really smart, rich guy, studied with me for a while. He didn't make it past class chapter 4, though. And he asked me, he said, is there a list of all the significations of the planets? And I said, there's not a list. You don't want a list. And he said, no, 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 I just want a list. Just give me, like, where can I go to get a list of everything that the sun rules, everything that the moon rules? And I said, there is none. And if you think like that, you're thinking wrong. And he was like, no, 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 there just has to be a list somewhere. And he was done. He was done studying with me. But he was trapped in the Ganita reality. He was trapped in a realm where everything can be calculated. So we even here are applying both left and right brain. We're going to look at certain key things that the sun represents, and then we're going to utilize those key things to feel into the things that live in that realm. So when I say higher rationality, super rational, we are going to the place where we're using our rationality to understand something that's much more that's greater than a rational mind can gather. Ration, if we just stay in rational realm, we're lost. If we go to the irrational, then we're just nuts. We're going to a super irrational. We're getting what they sometimes call a felt sense. We're getting this inherent understanding of how this thing works. So the sun represents the soul. And I just have certain things underlined here. So I'm just going to read off a few of these and then we'll talk about them a little bit, certain ones. But it represents the soul. So the soul is our core essence. It's our core nature. And it's what rules us. It's what makes us want what we want. So in the same way, it's like the king. Because of a country, the king is the soul of a country. He's guiding the country. And look at Trump. Trump is picking all these advisors who do what he wants. So he's now the soul of our country. And it's going in the direction that he wants. So he's the sun right now of our country. The sun represents respect, rulership, and power.
You're supposed to be a democracy.
still he's the soul. He's the soul of our country right now. The sun shows dharma, how we live. The sun shows self-esteem. Now, if the self-esteem, the sun also shows the father. So how is the self-esteem connected to the father?
If the father was encouraging, or if the father was discouraging,
mm-hmm.
How the father, how he supported the mm-hmm. child, what kind of values he gave to mm-hmm. the child.
Does that mean that everybody that doesn't have a father has no self-esteem?
No.
Okay. So how does self-esteem come in if the father's not there?
Father figures.
Father figures, other solar figures in the person's life.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that even if a person doesn't have a father, it's okay, but they have to have another strong masculine energy present.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have that reflection of what male energy is like.
Big brother.
And big brother, also the teachers, the people mm-hmm. that are in charge of them while they're younger, these authority figures then become very important.
Could it ever be physically the mother acting like the father, or is son always man?
It can also be parts of the mother. In her more solar aspect,
okay.
But there's going to be a transference happening, and that's going to show up in the self-esteem.
But usually it indicates a more male, like in the actual mundane
not
world.
Male, but authority.
Authority, so it could, okay.
There's probably mothers that are more solar,
mm-hmm.
and,
yeah.
father-like.
Fathers that are more lunar, but mm-hmm. it's representing the energy of authority, how you relate to authority. And how authority treats you while you're just very young and being formed. Meaning that those school teachers that your little kids are going to are influencing their self-esteem drastically.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So the sun is that which gives light. No other planets have light. So the sun is shining. It likes to be seen. People with sun in the rising sign want to be seen. The sun, because it's that which shines and everything else reflects it, it has this concept of unity, of oneness, where the moon is a reflector, so the moon becomes the energy of duality. So, and just taking that into account, we have Advaita Vedanta. In Advaita Vedanta, it's a religious belief that it's all one. It's non-dual. I'm one with God, and the whole universe is one. And then we have bhakti. And bhakti's all about, oh, it's me, and I love God, and I'm going to pray and sing to God. Which one is sun? Which one is moon?
Vedanta, Advaita
is sun. And bhakti is more moon. So you know, I didn't say what Advaita was, but we want to be able to get what the sun is and be able to get how that energy is showing up everywhere. This is how we want to see the planets. Sun represents spirituality because it's that deep soul nature. The birds are connected to the sun because they're the things that fly through the sky. They have that upliftment. They rise up. So the sun has this concept of rising up. People that are in power and respect, do we ever look down on them? We look up to them.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, when somebody is in a more powerful position, they put themselves in a higher platform or a bigger chair. It's this looking upward energy of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Which we see in the bird. So the sun is all about regularity. And where Saturn is the opposite. Saturn's the irregular planet. Sun is all about regularity. It's about the seasons. We have winter, we have summer, we have winter, we have summer, we have day, we have night, we have day, we have night. You can count on the sun setting. There's no doubt that the sun's not going to stop setting. And so the sun rules regularity. And in that regularity, it rules pulsation and time. It rules rhythm and music.
Will it rule inspiration too?
It can rule inspiration. But each planet can have inspiration mm-hmm. depending on what the thing is being inspired. Okay. Yeah. All right. So, and right eye is connected to the sun. Circulation, the heart, which is the pulsation in the body, and the skeleton in general, and the spine specifically. And what do we mean when somebody's spineless?
Coward, meek.
Coward, meek. They don't have that confidence. They don't have the strength. They don't have that, you know, this.
The confidence.
They don't lift up their chest and have that solar energy present. Sun afflicted causes all kinds of spinal problems. Sun afflicted causes all kinds of bone issues. So if we look at older women get
osteoporosis.
Now, from looking at it from a sun perspective, their bones are starting to deteriorate. Like, what do we want to have more in their life?
More confidence.
More get out there and do it. More power in their life.
That I can do it.
That I can do it. And just a sense of self-power. Mm. So, most important thing for the bones, from a astrological perspective. Mm-hmm. So, all right. Let's see. What about, okay, let's do the moon. Any questions with the sun? While you've been reading, any doubts that have arisen? All right. Take a drink before we do moon. So the sun, what do you think? Vata, pitta, or kapha?
Pitta.
You sure the sun's not kapha?
In your book you say vata, pitta magic.
Only has a little vata just because it dries out, you know, like the desert.
And a little kapha because what?
No kapha.
Okay, you're joking.
I'm joking. Yeah. I'm testing your logic here. The sun, there's no... What water do we get from the sun?
Sweat.
Evaporation.
Yeah.
All right, so the moon is vata kapha, and it's vata when it's waning and kapha when it's waxing. And Parashara, he says the moon is a hopeless romantic with sweet speech and a fickle mind. So that hopeless romantic, at least or to their detriment, their mind is always changing. So they're hopelessly in love with this person this week, and then next week hopelessly in love with someone else. And this is the moon. It's that changeableness. And the moon, it's a hopeless romantic because it's passionate. It has emotion to it. Then we have... the utilizer of resources. The moon is considered friendly to all. The moon connects to the mother. It rules the mother in the early childhood. Why would mother and early childhood be connected so closely?
Nurturing that you received because children need them.
Little children, they need nurturing. They're not looking for a big authority figure when they're really young. When they start to get older and need that more authority, that's when that solar energy comes in more. But that initial time, particularly the first year is completely mother energy. And if the moon is disturbed, not only is there going to be problems with the mother relationship, but there's going to be difficulties in that first year of life. And to really understand the deep, deep implications of that, there's something called attachment theory. And this is not in the book here. Attachment theory that came about by a psychologist named, his last name is Bowlby, B-O-L-B-Y. And Bowlby did a bunch of research, and he basically did our Jyotish research for us. He took hundreds and hundreds of people, looked at their childhood, their mother relationship, and how they were acting emotionally. And he learned how certain people, if their mother doesn't take care of their needs, it makes them close down and makes them not be very open. People where their mother's there sometimes, not there other times, they get something called a disorganized attachment, which kind of makes them very scattered. And particularly in relationship, it creates a lot of disturbance. And I'm not going to go too in depth into that, but Bowlby, if we look at his research, he didn't do anything with astrology, but everything he said completely fits to the moon in Vedic astrology and the mother relationship. And we can look at his chart, we can look at a chart and see the condition of the moon and know the attachment style of a person. Based on, and I've at some points, I've just read what Bowlby wrote about certain things, and the person's like, oh my gosh, how do you know that about me? And it's, you know, Saturn aspects the moon, and I read what, you know, that type of attachment brings. So, so how the mother is, how that early bit of childhood is, and how that affects our emotional body, there's deep science behind it, like really deep science. Moon. Moon is, it's white. And think about white clothes. How easily they get dirty. Mm-hmm. You know, and depending what dirt you're playing with or what food you're eating, it automatically becomes that color. If you're having strawberry ice cream, then that white shirt's gonna quickly have that strawberry color. And so the moon, whatever planet it hangs out with, it flavors the mind, it flavors the emotional life. And the two extremes that I bring up in this section here is Saturn. Saturn brings a big pessimism, and Jupiter brings the big optimism. So somebody that has moon conjunct Jupiter, you know, you can sit there and say you're going bankrupt. And they're like, well, at least I don't have any loans anymore. Person with Saturn conjunct the moon, you say you're going bank, you say you just got a raise, and they're like, oh, it's still not enough money, you know, like, so this how we look at life is completely flavored by what the moon is, planets it's conjunct, the sign it's in, and we'll have a whole chapter on the nakshatra and how that flavors the perception as well. But the moon, it's really putting on the color of lenses that we have.
How is that, like when you say that the moon takes up the flavor, the color of what it's with?
The rasa.
So does Rahu. Rahu also takes up the attributes of what it's with. So how, give me an example of a moon taking up something
in what way would,
and Rahu taking
in which way would Rahu take up something?
Doesn't Rahu also, I know it acts like Saturn.
It acts like Saturn.
So it just acts like Saturn. It doesn't matter who it's with. It doesn't.
For me, I like to say Rahu acts like Rahu. When we say it acts like Saturn, that statement is based on how we read it in signs and how it interacts with each sign.
Okay.
So, you know, it's a Vata Graha. And
so,
in that Vata nature, it acts like Saturn. But it has its own qualities.
It doesn't. Am I wrong about what I'm thinking? That it adapts.
There's some people that say that, but I don't.
You don't say it adapts.
I don't
its
go
own
that.
Thing.
Oh, I fully take it as its own.
So then, only Mercury and Moon adapt.
So Mercury adapts in the nature of he's that person who, and I'm sure you've seen that chameleon kind of person who, when they hang out with the bad boys. they kind of act all tough mm-hmm. and bad, and then when they hang out with just the sweet people, then they like, or, you know, it's like where who are you really? Mm-hmm. And you have a hard time really knowing who Mercury is, because he's all about fitting in on a certain level with social situations.
So can you give an example of how the moon would fit in and the Mercury would fit
in? The moon is not fitting in. The moon's being the moon.
It's just taking on...
The moon is not the moon that's changing. It's your vision that's changing. The moon is still being the moon. It's still representing the mother. It's still giving benefic or malefic nature based upon its waxing and waning.
So if it's with a benefic, it's more fortuitous for the moon, and if it's with a malefic, it's more
fortuitous. Let's, instead of saying the moon, let's say it's more fortuitous for your perspective. Mm. We'll get very specific. And we're really looking at, in this case, the moon changing your view of the world. How you view things.
It's changing. It's coloring your perception.
It's coloring your perception.
How is that different from Mercury coloring your perception?
Mercury's not coloring your perception. Okay, he's changing how your intellect is functioning.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right, I got what you're saying.
You know, Mercury is about decision making and memory and you know, like whether your speech, how, and you know, if Mercury's with Saturn, person has really dry, blunt speech.
So if Jupiter was with the moon, then you might have a more, like you said before, optimistic outlook. And if Mercury was with Jupiter, you may talk about high philosophical.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you'd also talk very nice, and you'd use big words, and mm-hmm. you'd say things in a very nice way.
But doesn't that go with all the planets? Don't all the planets,
but the big thing is, and that's why I changed it from you talking about the planet to you talking about the action. Mm-hmm. Because you see, we don't want to talk about the planet too abstractly, because let's ground it in reality. Moon perspective.
Okay.
Because now, you know, moon with Saturn is also going to make a mother who's much more harsh, much more reserved. Mm-hmm. If it's a weak moon, it might even make the mother an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. If Jupiter is with the moon, it's going to make the mother maybe a teacher, somebody who's very sharing, very open. So it's influencing the mother in that way.
So it's the quality.
Now, if your mother's very open, mm-hmm. what kind of perspective, very open and generous, what kind of perspective is that going to give you in life?
A more positive one, definitely.
Totally. And if your mom is an alcoholic and never like shares anything of her inner world.
A heavier one.
Yeah, so it's reflected like that way.
Okay, thank you.
And Mercury will also be reflected in its archetypes in that way.
But is it...
And Rahu the same way.
But is Moon more so because it is pure and white, like you said, because it is so nurturing and giving and open? Does it get affected more so or no by that? It's more easily disturbed.
It's really just a metaphor. It's really just a metaphor saying that it's white, so it takes on the perspective.
But isn't it true that the moon is more easily disturbed as well?
The thing is, your perspective, if we think about perspective, uh-huh. perspective is like my glasses.
Right.
They're just clear. Mm-hmm. Now, I put on a black frame, or I could put on a red frame. Mm-hmm. So the frame, the viewpoint can change based upon the planet, but it's just because it's the perspective. Is,
sure.
The moon is just this thing that I'm seeing with and also feeling with.
But the moon is fickle, so it gets affected more. So when you do like matching charts or synastry charts, then you don't they look at the moon because just
the, look the, at the moon just the because quality that's our
of the moon is fickle. The quality of the moon is changeable. That's
not the reason we look at the moon. Yeah.
But that would impact the moon more. Is all I'm.
More. I don't want to use the word more.
Okay. Maybe
yeah.
I'm not saying it.
Yeah.
Right. maybe
just let go of the concept of more and just get the each is affecting it, and you see, because more is
I see in its own way.
More is it's like, what does more mean? Right. More meaning a dump truck, more meaning a mountain more.
No, it's just more sensitive. The moon is more sensitive because it's more changeable.
But let's just be very specific and say it's influencing the viewpoint.
Okay.
And then we're direct influencing what's happening, and it's flavoring what the mom looks like, which thereby flavors our perspective. And it also is it's this capacity of feeling.
I see.
And that capacity...
that's a big... Thank you. Yeah.
Capacity of feeling. And that capacity of feeling, mm-hmm. compared to how I'm speaking, you know, it's a very different thing in its impact on people.
Yes.
But we just want to be specific and not just use a word like more.
Okay.
Because it can mean so much.
Yes.
All right, so a little bit more here for the moon. And we're going a bit over. Everybody's okay going over, yeah? Recording will be online if you need to leave sooner. So, all right. Oh, why is Venus enemy to the moon? Yes. there's many reasons, and I'm going to give you two. Venus is a young teenage girl who wants to party, and Moon is the responsible woman who's working and saying you need to take care of things. You think those two get along?
No, teenage mom and daughter.
Think about you when you were a teenager with your mom, you know?
Moon is exalted and Venus is sad.
No, that's not the rules of exaltation, though. Mm. The traditional statement, though, is the dancing girl ends the life of the dancing girl ends at pregnancy. And it's just a little traditional statement. And it means that, you know, you can party and go dancing and have lots of fun, but as soon as you have a baby, oof, you got this little baby to take care of and you're carrying it around and all next baby's coming and you're not sleeping at night. There's no time to go party and have and dance all the time and travel around. And so the style of life of Venus is very different than the style of life of the moon. And so when we're looking at planetary friendships and inimical nature, and we'll go deeper into this in, I think it's the Bhava chapter, a little bit with friendships and enemies. And really the friendship and enemies are all about the nature of these planets. Like how does this planet like to live its life and how does that planet like to live its life? And are they compatible to be living together? You know, the lifestyle that Venus likes to live, Venus wants to be dating and having fun and partying and, you know, she's a crazy artist dancing girl. And the moon, she's got a kid to take care of and she wants to make sure that there's not too many men coming in and out of the house or she's married and, you know, there isn't that. So it's a completely different life.
But then why are Venus and Saturn friends then? Because Saturn's completely different than Venus and they're buddies.
Oh, but Saturn, Saturn's
opposite
not,
Venus.
He's not disciplinarian. He's the plumber.
Taskmaster.
He's the plumber. He's the farmer. He's the plumber. He's the farmer. He's the electrician that did whatever, you know what I mean? He's this worker. Now, does that worker, does he want to go hang out with your mom after work, or does he want to go hang out with the dancing girls after work?
Okay, that's
okay. So it's a little analogy, and there's deeper reasonings there, but that's the simple
like
way
that.
To understand
yeah.
it.
I look at it also as, you know, Saturn's like our suffering, and so much art comes out of it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good way to say it.
Another way to say it.
I like that. That's great.
That's great to me.
All right, so moon. Moon's all about the sense organs, our sense of security and vulnerability, which is, as I talked about, the attachment style. That's all they talk about, all that in there. Mind works through patterns of thought. It works through images. This is all related to the moon. And the moon is about melody and singing. It's when we think about music, the rhythm is sun, but the melody and the flavor, the feeling, this what the music is making us feel, that's the moon. And from the Vedic perspective, it's the singer that really is the one in control of how a person feels. The music can be really intense in the rhythm, but if the singer starts going sweet on top of that, it pierces that space inside of you. moon rules washing, water, rules food and herbs, the nourishment, and it rules prana. And I go a little bit into the prana there, but not to the depth. Anybody who wants to know more about prana and mind, I have an article again on my blog that I think it's called, I don't know, I have two articles on mind and prana on there that really talk about how prana affects our consciousness and thought process. And so that correlation between those two. All right. And so on the medical side, the moon, it rules the rakta, the blood. It rules the bodily fluids. It rules the stomach and the lungs. And the stomach in the sense of what I can stomach. And when the moon is worrying, the stomach, it's just not. You don't want to eat when you get, worry just kills the appetite. And at the same time, grief and fear that the moon experiences, we feel in the lungs. So affliction to the moon will hurt the lungs and it'll hurt the stomach.
So again, with the moon with Jupiter and moon with Saturn, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Let's go to the lungs. And
yeah.
So if the moon would be with Jupiter, mm-hmm. would that mean you'd be able to stomach more? Because my gut would say moon with Jupiter would make you stomach actually less, and Saturn would let you stomach more because Saturn can take more pain and suffering. Now I got it backwards.
Oh, yeah.
Because so Jupiter is
what happens with Jupiter, it makes the moon have a positive viewpoint. So you know, it's like if you don't get paid by the your car by the end of the month, you're not going to pay your rent. Jupiter with the moon says, "I'll sell it, car. It'll get sold. I'm not worried." And you know, so it doesn't create the worry. It has such optimism. Where Saturn, you know, it you have 30 days left. And he's like, "Oh, what if nobody buys my car?" And like, it's.
So Saturn limits the amount that one can take.
Saturn's constricting.
Yeah,
so he's constricting.
Limit, but is there a way that we can also see Saturn, because people with heavy Saturn seem to be able to take a lot more hard work?
Heavy
take
Saturn
a lot
doesn't
more
mean conjunct the
suffering.
Moon. Suffering. A strong no, Saturn but doesn't mean conjunct the
because
moon.
Because Saturn can indicate it is a karaka of
he needs to be like in a Shasha Mahapurusha yoga or some strong place.
We can't read it like
can't read
because
it
it's
the
with
moon.
The moon it can
doesn't
take more it. Like it can emotionally take more. No. One can emotionally take on harder.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. We want the moon to be strong in the Bala.
So with Jupiter you can actually take more suffering than with the Saturn and moon.
Well, the thing is you don't even see it as suffering,
right?
With it.
So you can handle it.
You can take like even, you know, you have you seen these stories where it's a vet who lost his leg and he did some great thing and ran a marathon anyway?
Yes.
He's got moon Jupiter something going on.
I have moon Jupiter. I've suffered. Yeah. I suffer emotionally, you know, a lot, and I have moon Jupiter. So when I see things like that, it just makes me sort of question if
we got to go into the strength, because if the moon is weak, it doesn't matter.
Right, okay.
And we'll go into strength chapter in
and right,
in
it is
seven.
A waning moon, so okay. Thank
All
you.
Right. Yes. So we got sun and moon, and let's see. And we're over in time, but let's see. First, any questions relative to that? Yes, Rachel.
I guess you said that the moon relates to rakta, and it makes sense that it's related to rasa and stomach and lungs, but I don't really understand why it's related to rakta, because blood is so pitta.
Mm.
Liquid,
because
it's fluid.
Right? It's fluid, one. It's the rakta. The rasa goes to... the rakta is the feeling sense of the fluid. It's where the lineage is connected. It's where our genetic energy... When we say, you know, like, we're of the same blood... We're talking about lineage there. We're talking about our relation. And so we're talking about that rakta. We're from the same mom, where we have that same, we're our mother's mother. There's this fat, familiar family connection with
bloodline.
That. Bloodline.
Yeah.
And rakta is where rasa is experienced. And when I say, and rasa, and we have two different meanings of rasa. Rasa is the, you study Ayurveda, correct? So there's the rasa dhatu, and the rasa dhatu is connected to mercury. And the rasa dhatu is, do you know it's upadhatu? Tested her.
Like mucus.
Skin. And the upadhatu of rakta?
Bile.
Yeah. So the upadhatu of rakta is bile, so it's going right into the stomach to show how we can digest things. Where the upadhatu of the rasa is the skin. And so the skin is this membrane of communication. You know, when somebody gets embarrassed, their face turns red. When somebody is afraid, that their hair skin might stand up and they go white, they go pale. Mm-hmm. When somebody's angry, it's a very different flush than embarrassment. So the and if we just look at somebody's face, and you know, the most modern technology on detecting whether somebody's lying has to do with looking at their face and whether the expressions, and they use cameras these days, whether the muscle, the micro movements of the face match the words they're saying. And they can show that when somebody's lying, the micro muscles don't match the words. The micro movements. So this movement of the face, the color of the face and the skin and the communication, it's all a communication that's coming from you. So we see the skin and the rasa is also, it's changing the flushness, it's changing the shine, and it's communicating through the whole body. It's moving the hormones through the body, it's moving hormones and what else? It's, you know, it's transmitting stuff. It's a communicator in the body. Where the rakta is giving a feeling, and the moon and the mercury are together in there. You know, the rasa and the rakta they're mixed, and we can separate them if we take the blood out, but they're moving through that the same system. And the rakta is associated with, and so it's on the level, it's rasa as the flavor, that, you know, I'm feeling good, I'm happy, I'm sad, I'm excited, I'm depressed, you know, all these feelings, they're all coming through the rakta. It's you know, does it, what's the saying that talks about it, it's getting your blood anger, oh, yeah. It gets your blood boiling, you know, so anger is in that boiling of the blood. So that's the rakta, that's Mars moon. It's boiling your blood. And the relationship I talked about in the beginning, the boyfriend had that Mars moon, his blood's boiling. So I knew his blood was boiling. I didn't know how exactly it was coming out, but you know, it only took a second and it was very clear how it was coming out. But his blood was boiling. Does that make sense? All right. When you learn about the dhatus in Ayurveda, you're really learning about them from a very physical perspective. Let's see. Blood is made in the bones. Does that mean that the moon comes from the sun? It means that the shine of the moon is coming from the bones. And just for the recording, Ravi wrote, "Blood is made in the bones. Does that mean that the moon comes from the sun?" And we could do reflection or something like that there relative to that. Oh, where was I going? I was going. So in Ayurveda, when you're studying about the dhatus, the seven, the Sapta Dhatu, in Ayurveda school, you're really learning about from the materialistic perspective. You're fully focused on Stula Sharira, and that is the most important thing if you're studying Ayurveda. But when we look at the Sapta Dhatu from the Jyotish perspective, we're looking at it almost completely psychological. We're really looking at what does it mean to me on a much more metaphysical level. We're looking at the rasa as this thing that's communicating to us. We're looking at the blood as this thing that's moving feeling throughout the whole body. When we look at the muscle, we're looking at our forcefulness, our strength, and it's a strength in a not just like physical strength way, but the strength of our will. So we're looking at all these dhatus really. The physical level becomes, and so there's a term darshana. You know, if you're looking at the bottom, if you're at the bottom of a mountain, looking up at the mountain, what it looks like, or if you're at the top of the mountain, looking down at what the mountain looks like. So when we're from the Ayurvedic perspective, we're really looking from the bottom of the mountain, saying, this is the Stula Sharira. You know, physical body, here you are, this is how you're functioning. And it's important to be that way. From the Jyotish perspective, we're in the stars, so we're in the top of the mountain, we're looking down. We're liking, so this is where you come from. It's a totally different angle. And both are prop, both, they're just different perspectives, just different views. And similar to the tastes, when we look at the taste from a Jyotish perspective, we're completely on an emotional level. It has nothing to do with herbs or foods or anything like that. It's completely what is the psychological emotional level that taste is bringing into my mind and into my being. Which is why we have for Mars. Mars is the bitter taste. And you know, you might say, well, bitter is not hot. Bitter is not a fire. You know, taste. But Mars, there's nothing that makes, Mars rules a breakup in a relationship. What can make you more bitter than a breakup?
Wasn't bitter Saturn?
Astringent is Saturn.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So that bitterness of the fighting in the end, when you're, what are you left with? You're left with this bitter emotion. So it's, we're looking at that psychological level of all these things. And now they show up on a physical level. And I mentioned it in the very beginning, karmaja vyadi, disease that's coming from karma. So now if somebody is, I remember when I was doing my internship in India for Ayurveda, and this guy came into the clinic with this terrible skin disease. And he would have like 16 to 20 cups of tea a day. And 16 to 20 cups of tea. And, you know, it's Indian tea. So it's, who knows, you know, what's in there and all. And he had a terrible skin issue. We were doing leech therapy on him. And the doctor that I was working with, one of the big things is like, okay, you got to not drink so much tea. And the guy was, and the doctor I was working with, he was trying to get him to do herbal tea instead. You know, like, why don't you do some, simple herbal Tulsi tea? And the guy, you know, he was addicted to his chai. And so for that, we see that, you know, we don't need to use Jyotish in that perspective. But now what if the guy had a completely healthy diet? He's a vegan. He does yoga all the time. And then he has some terrible skin inflammation that he's suffered with since he was a little kid. There's no food that he's eating that calls that. So on that level, we got to look at the rasa from a psychological perspective. We got to see what the archetype is creating, you know, what in his consciousness is generating, what in his consciousness and his karma gave birth. Karma ja, the birth, born from karma, gave birth to his skin not forming properly. And then we work on that the more psychological and causal level to deal with his skin. So at different times, those different darshanas become more prominent than the other. So that guy who he's vegan, yogi, clean, pure life, and he has some terrible inflammations. You know, looking at him physically, it's worthless. So a place for everything. All right. So as I said, continue reading each graha. I'm gone next week. And Ian is going to start the Rashi chapter. So listen to the whole thing, read it. Important thing in that chapter, people sometimes get really confused with Western astrology and Vedic astrology. And they when we do signs, they want Western astrology. They want to know that Taurus people are very attached and the Virgo people are very neat and organized. And that's just completely Western astrology. It has nothing... The Vedic world, it's a very different perspective. Some people have said that my Rashi chapter is a little... doesn't give enough. It gives more than enough. It's really working on the archetypal level and really trying to get you... We're approaching it from a very traditional Vedic perspective. All right. So dig into that, and we're good.
Thank you.
I'll see you all in 2 weeks, and enjoy Ian next week.
Do you want me to?
Yeah.
Okay.
You have been kicked.
Yeah. I'm going to Mexico. Nice. He knows why. But I'm going to be gone for like 3 weeks.
I use these examples?
No, because he was doing
that. The thing is, it's so hard to think up a random example. So I'm using the examples that either I had in my clients today or that are in the room right now.
So earlier when he's like, should I go to school or should I run off to Mexico? Anyway, that's who's referred. But I am going. I'm going to be here next week for class with Ian. Uh-huh. But then I'm going to miss... I'm going to miss class for 3 weeks.
And I spaced it, but I'm going to write her and see if I can share. I had a client last week or the week before, and she's in a course where there's these people from Mexico coming up here teaching people to do therapy with, I don't know whether it's mushrooms or ayahuasca, but it's like a training.
Oh, wow.
For that. And they're coming up to California like once a month
great.
This whole thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah. If you remember, just shoot me. If I'm allowed to.
The big thing is it's...
Contact them. You know,
the big thing is it's more approaching that client in the way that works, you know.
Therapeutics using...
So, I'm going to be gone... Next week I'll be here, but the week after, which I guess it's the first week of March, until I return on the 20th, so I might miss two classes, maybe three. I don't have a calendar. Yes.
Right now...
What should... Hi, Amrita. Or she just going to the bathroom?
Went to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So right now, if you go online, all the classes... Just, you know, that way you're staying on the same page as the rest of the cohort.
So what are we going to be on for the next, until the week of March 20th, the 20th of March I'll be back.
But just if you go to the course one page mm-hmm. at the, right here, class meetings, that's where classes get uploaded. So you can go here and listen to the classes that you'll miss. That way you're staying in tune with the cohort.
Is it uploaded already?
Those are the last few weeks.
Oh, you have 17. Okay. And then, Freedom, I need to pay you. And I owe you money for the course and for the, not this book, because I paid for this book already, the first volume, but the, your second volume, I took a copy of it from here, so I owe you for that. So I brought money for that. Okay. But I don't know how much the course is in the book is.
Course is, let's see, I think it's 1008 for course one. Have you paid anything yet?
No, nothing for the course and the
resources,
book.
Accreditation, tuition fees. I think because course one and course two are different. I think course two is more. Yeah, course one's 1008, course two is 1200. Just because there's so much more material in course two.
Okay, so I have 1000.
And I also have more fun with my course two.
Yeah, because you could talk more.
Yeah,
because
they know.
And then actually, the book is how much the book?
Course two, like they also, 33.
33 for the book. Yeah. Okay.
Which just round it into, and you don't have to do ones or whatever.
I know. Do you have 2 tens?
I think there's just 20s up there.
So what's 33 and 108 equal?
So that is 40, 1050, right? That would
no.
be. No. 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 Let's see. Or 1040?
33 and 108.
Plus 33. 1041.
1041.
So it's 1040.
Okay. So 1041, though, because just you want to give that extra. No, okay.
But yeah, so look, just, and then that way you can be on this, you know what people know in the class and what they don't know. That way you can.
Yes, but do you know in the end of March what chapters at least? I've read up to chapter 7.
So when are you
leaving? I've done up to chapter 8.
When are you leaving?
I'm here next week, but the week after for 2 or 3 weeks.
It's all, you know, the way I used to do it, like where I had like this day we do this day we do that, and I just don't do it anymore.
Right.
Because I just kind of
flow more.
I just kind of flow, feel it out. That way if I want to talk more about something, I just can and... Mm. And like otherwise if I was like set on a thing, I wouldn't have read all those. Like, I mean, that was fun reading the stuff from Abhinavagupta, wasn't it?
Yeah. But do they know who Abhinavagupta is?
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
So I wanted to show you.
they know it's an official something, right? Yeah. You know, from the 8th century. But yeah, just to see, you know, I wouldn't have had, if we were on a set schedule, I wouldn't have had time to read that. And so by not having a set schedule, it just kind of
won't get past chapter 7, though.
No.
Okay, so I'm up to that point.
Yeah. The last two groups, though, I was really lax with where people were and letting people be at different spaces.
Yeah.
And
didn't work very good for me.
The thing is, you're that last one that you guys were in was the most. Before, it was always people were like maybe 2 or 3 chapters away from each other.
Yeah, that was really hard.
And then that last one, it got to be too far that it didn't work. And so now I've gone to the complete opposite again. And I'm just like keeping everybody together this time.
It's nice to review.
Because I felt like most of every class you were speaking, I was so behind that none of the information made any sense to me. So it was just not the right time.
I don't know if I'm going to teach a level one again.
Really?
Yeah.
So we're lucky.
And the next time I teach a level one, I want to teach it. I want to re-record. And I want to teach it only for licensed professionals. So that way I'm in a room with a bunch of like chiropractors, psychologists. Yeah. That way it's just at a
higher level.
It's just at a level of people that are seeing clients all day and how they can apply it and how it's going to help them. And I'm going to teach, you know, to teach it all at that level.
Right.
That way it's a very different, and it'll still be, I'll put the recordings onto the same, you know, this same zone, that way anybody taking it can do it, but I'm going to just have Ian teach it, you know.
Yeah, he's good too. He's a good teacher. Yeah. I want to ask one question I didn't get to ask in class about Venus, right? Uh-huh. About this Venus retrograde period in Pisces.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm doing a lot of...
the worst place to go retrograde.
It's the worst. How? I thought Venus, it was exalted.
It's exalted, but exalted. When it goes retrograde, it becomes
Nietzsche.
Uchabunga.
Oh, Uchabunga. Right.
Uchabunga. It becomes debilitated.
High falling down from.
It falls from a very high place.
It's and in it's my like, luck now.
It's like one thing to stumble like in the here. It's another thing to stumble down the steps. It's another thing to be on a very tall mountain and then the fall and roll.
Oh no, it's in my lugna. It's opposite my seventh house.
It's fine. It's fine.
No, I wanted to ask.
It's a quick transit.
It's 4 months.
Just don't get back involved with any old lovers.
No, God, no.
It's 4 months long.
But that's only when it starts, right? Like, if I got involved with an old lover before it started, it's okay, right? No, right? No, these are legitimate questions.
It's still indicative.
But it'll still cause balagan.
It'll still cause you to go into that zone.
But why did you say old lovers in particular? Because it's in Pisces?
Just Venus retrograde. Venus retrograde's always going into
revisiting
old lovers and the old things, and you know, like that person that you had old stuff with, and then you call them up and you talk and you miss that old time, or if you're single, reopening an old doorway. That's what I said. Well, the thing is, it can pull you back in, which is fine, but the thing is then what happens when Venus goes direct.
Right, then it changes again.
Then all of a sudden, then you're not interested in going back in. It's like you're like, no. I moved on from this.
Is it about time to get a haircut? I wanted to ask if it's
haircut's all about just the tithy.
A Libra, like a Libra ascendant, right?
Because so Venus goes retrograde April 3rd.
It's retrograde. It's getting there. Yeah, April 3rd.
It's not retrograde yet.
It's getting in the retrograde, like the, you know how they sometimes calculate, even though it's going direct, then it's going to stop and go back over the point and then stop and go back.
Right.
So it's in that, what other astrologers call, they would call it shadow, right? Like, but we wouldn't. So if it's in Libra, so if you have a Libra ascendant, because I'm practicing charts now and I'm doing a lot of study. And don't look at the planets in this, I'm just looking at. So Libra, so that ascendant Venus rules the eighth house and the lagna, and it's transiting the sixth, mm-hmm. right? So Venus is transiting the sixth,
and, you know, that's
and it rules
least
the first
house.
And eighth.
That's so
because
bad.
It's the house
it's
of Virgo.
Marna Karkastana.
Because it's house of Virgo.
But it's,
yeah.
No, it's because it's Marna Karkastana.
Because Venus is Marna Karkastana
in the sixth. In the sixth, period. Yeah. Not anything.
So it's Marna Karkastana, and it's becoming Uchabunga at the same time.
So, but in my reading the charts, and again, not looking at this person's chart in particular, but just looking at the houses and the placements, so. That's a big transit for Libra ascendants because it's activating
what's the
sixth.
Though? What's the dasha?
This person's is Mercury Venus.
So Venus is active. So yes, then it becomes big. But you really need a Venus Maha or Antara to make it a big transit.
So I'm in Saturn Venus Antara.
So the Venus is going to be
more influential.
Uh-huh.
So it can change the way I feel beautiful about myself.
Beautiful about yourself. Venus is invoking relationship and love
and
style.
And here it would also affect the person's lagna because it owns the lagna and the eighth. Mm-hmm. So when it happens, it will activate like this person's self-worth.
Well, the thing is, it's activated because of the dasha, not
right?
because of the transit.
But the transit also activates, doesn't it? Not as much, really?
The transit's going to be somewhere every
year.
Every year, every day,
it's
going to
be
somewhere.
The same thing.
So there's always a transit.
Okay, even though it's a long transit, like this long transit of Saturn affects because it's a 2.5
Saturn,
year.
Saturn, Rahu, and Jupiter are the
different.
Most important transits.
So we don't
They're
pay that
different.
Much attention.
We don't pay that. In Western astrology, they pay huge attention to it. In Vedic, they're considered tertiary transits unless it's the dasha.
Okay, so help me look at this then just real quick. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm an astrologer, I could tell this person that this upcoming few months, mm-hmm. transiting through the sixth house, maybe
but
that
when
they
it's direct,
would change.
When it's direct, it's going to be great. And when it's
but
direct,
I don't even know how to say anything about it. Like
because
it
when it's direct, exaltation cancels Marna Karkastana.
Okay.
So it's going to show he's resolving all. Is it a he or a she?
It's Marco.
Marco.
Yeah.
So it shows when it's direct. He's going to start resolving all kinds of his relationship issues, which he's probably doing right now. All kinds of good stuff's coming out.
And then this it and goes that. April 3rd.
And then April 3rd, it goes retrograde, and then the fall happens. And then he got it. Then when it goes direct again, he makes up for it all. And
how many months is it retro in the Vedic?
It's the same. It's the Vedic.
But then why did you say April 3rd in the Western? They're not saying April 3rd. They're saying
it should be the same, right? Yeah, it's 100% right. The same.
And then this bit, Freedom, right here. I wanted to just let you know this. Remember the question I asked you about this person? Do you remember the question I asked you and you said regarding its psychology and whether it's a pathological thing or not? Uh-huh. Remember, I thought he was covert narcissism part.
Okay.
Well, I just got confirmation that it's covert true.
Narcissism.
Yeah. I don't know if it's pathological, but it is. Yeah. It definitely is. So I don't know what indications would make that up. When you looked at it, you're like, not sure, but this is just to let you know, yes, 100%.
If we look.
If this helps you at all.
If we look at his attachment style, it's called.
It's called covert narcissism attachment style is what it is. it really truly is. And I didn't want to believe it, you know, but now that we've broken up, all of the things that come with it, like with the malignant sort of thing.
Anxious avoidant attachment.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the big thing that's going on with his moon.
Yeah. Anxious attachment. Avoidant. And would disorganized also fall under that category? Ambivalent.
Is there a Rahu? Is there Rahu connected to it?
No, but he's definitely... No, Rahu might be aspecting it, might be doing
if
Rashi.
Rahu's aspect,
like 5 and 9.
Graha. Yeah, it's aspecting it. So then we have the disorganized. So you see how that's changing
and
to disorganized?
And Sun and Mercury and Ascendant are aspecting.
Yeah, but that's not going to change it.
That won't make him into a pathological narcissist.
It's the fact that Saturn and Rahu are aspecting it that's creating the disorganized attachment.
Okay.
And the narcissism, that's just the debilitated Sun and Lagna. And it's Sankranti.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when you looked at it and when you did it, you were like, no, I don't think so.
Would I call it narcissism? I don't know if I'd call it narcissism.
Would you call it pathological was the question. That was the question.
It's all pathological on a certain level, but I call it a Sankranti Sun in Lagna, debilitated, you know? So... So these Western terms, they change every 30, 40 years.
Oh, yeah. This we know.
So the thing is, do we use one of those Western ones or do we just stick with ours? Because the attachment styles, I mean, it's so perfect. It fits 100%. Yeah. It's gorgeous. Have you read about the attachment styles?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It fits so perfectly. Yeah. And I use it for relationship counseling so much these days.
It's on Wikipedia?
Okay. You can Wikipedia, right. There's books, there's tons of stuff on it. It's literally the hottest theory in psychology.
Yeah,
right
I've heard
now.
Too much about it.
Bowlby, B-O-W-L, like bowl, and then B-Y.
That's all people are talking about right now in psychology. It's a bit...
Bowlby? Like, B-Y?
The thing is, they're all talking about it because they're like, wow, it works!
Right.
Wow, it does affect how a person is in a relationship. Wow, it does affect how they are emotionally. Like, it's the hot thing because they actually have something that, like, works and is scientific.
Yeah.
Like, they can test somebody and then it, like,
it
actually
shows
works.
Results. Yeah, and that's hard in psychology.
And it's really hard. And so the fact that they have something that's so consistent, it's just everything is, it's changing everything in the whole realm. But for us, it's only the moon. Attachment style is only showing the moon. It doesn't show us the sun. It doesn't show us Mercury. You know what I mean? So so they're going all into that, but they're missing all those other planets.
And you know what? If someone knows Jyotish, looking at that chart, they would, like you told me right away when I showed you, you're like, this person has a real negative mindset, gets really depressed, gets really dark in his head. And I'm like, no, he doesn't. He's exuberant and buoyant and happy-go-lucky. And when you can read the chart, you can tell when someone's actually not acting the way in accordance with either
or when they're acting
or you have the wrong chart or you have the wrong time. Exactly.
They might have like an over compensation tendency,
like or when they're in a good mood, mm-hmm. they take advantage of it because they know that as soon as that's gone they're going to go back into a dark space. So enjoy you know, while you can. Anyway, thank you. This is for you, Freedom. Thank you so much. You know, I took a leave of absence, right? So I think I'm going to start again in the fall.
Nice. So you are going to start again in the
fall. I think so. I'm not going to tell you anything for sure, but I'm going to give the astrology a year.
I would start in the summer. If you're good. Either start in the summer or start in the winter.
Why?
Because it's the week-long intensive.
And it'll give me a taste.
It's way better than the fall and the spring are kind of like...
If they're going to force me...
The summer and the winter are so much more fun.
If they're going to force me to do the online course again, I'm not going to redo it. Yeah. I cannot learn like this.
If they get
WASC... I failed. Do you know that?
Really?
Yeah.
If they get WASC approval, then they're going to have like triple the number of people there. If they don't get WASC approval this winter... because I got my master's from them.
Yeah.
And I'll transfer to CIIS
for
my PhD.
When will we know if they're going to get it?
We'll know in 2 weeks.
Will you tell me?
Uh-huh. Which school?
Okay.
Meridian University, where I'm getting my PhD.
Nice to meet you.
But if they don't get WASC approval, if they don't get WASC approval, then I'm going to be at CIIS. Yeah. And it's an extra... $10,000 a year.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's quite a lot. How much longer do you have?
A year and a half if I stay at Meridian. 2 years if I go to CIIS.
Meridian?
No, it's in Petaluma.
Yeah.
You should check it out if you're interested, but wait till they get the approval.
The thing is, I have a year and a half if I at Meridian, where if I transfer, I'll have 2 years. So it's tough if I transfer.
Yeah.
And it's more money.
No.
And it's more expensive too. Yeah.
I really don't want to start. I need a break. I realized after Act One that it was too much, too fast, too soon.
At the same time, it was a dive into something else.
I wasn't close, but I met him. Yeah.
So after that, it was just too much.
It's I couldn't. Friends of his that came to that puja that were acting.
Oh, intense. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's cool.
Let me know if you're going to do pujas and stuff. I really need to be... Can you keep me in touch? I really need to start going out. I would love that. I need to start coming out of my...
Yes.
Wherever it is I've been.
But if you go back to Meridian, if you do end up back at Meridian... winter or summer, start with one of those week-longs.
I don't think I have a choice. I think I'm going to have to redo fall. I failed. I could have taken an incomplete, and this is what really pisses me off.
Yeah.
Had they told me earlier, anyway, I could have taken an incomplete. I wouldn't have lost all my tuition.
Uh-huh.
I lost all my tuition for the first quarter.
Oh, my God.
And I made an appeal, and I asked them, look, please don't let...
Give you the incomplete?
Either give me an incomplete or give me credit for the amount I paid towards next quarter.
Yeah.
And I'll, if there's any... difference in price, I'll pay the difference, but give me credit. It's too much.
Ask to get the incomplete. Appeal for the incomplete and complete.
I'll try again.
Did you not finish your paperwork or did
I
you
just,
not?
I could not do it, Freedom. Yeah. I couldn't. Like I told you when I met.
I can't do the online stuff.
I could not do it. It was like Saturn, like boulder. Boulder on me, and as soon as I decided I'm not going to do it, it was gone.
Uh-huh.
And with the Jyotish, I can't not do it. All I do at home is study and look at videos and research, and that's all I've been doing for months. Mm-hmm. You know, I should be smarter by now, but I'm not. But I'll get there.
I have 20 years with the world's greatest guru. So don't compare yourself to me.
That is a joy. That's a joy. I get so excited. It's something that I'm going to learn for the rest of my life. You can never stop learning. I'll always learn more.
When I'm in India, I have 80-year-old men touching my feet in some of these things. Like,
I'll touch your feet right now. I don't like touching.
But I'm just saying, you know, don't like, you know, when I look at a chart, don't you know, where you are is a beginner level and where I'm at is...
Of course, yeah. I'm gonna always be a beginner in my mind, at least, you know. Until I mean, I'm not in my
at
mind.
At some point, we get to be a professional, one day, and we're still learning. We're still students, but not a beginner.
But I thought that have a beginner mind.
Beginner mind, but we stay students. But you know, there is.
There's always more to learn.
Yeah. That's often in my mantra.
Yeah.
Show me.
Yeah.
I mean, you go deeper. Because like, once you know? Think you know,
yeah,
it's
then you're
like
stuck. You can't grow because you, oh, I know already, you know? So, but the
Show me. And then when you get.
Which is how like a lot of these ACVA people are with Guru, with Sanjay. They all act like they all know, and so they're not learning anything from them.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's like, years are going by and they're not learning. And it's like, I'm like, okay, you know?
Yeah. So we'll see about that. You know, all I felt, well, I thought I had to suffer because of Saturn, because I'm in Saturn Mahadasha.
Uh-huh.
So I thought, oh no, I have to push through with school. I have to do the work.
It just means you have to work hard.
But then someone's like, no, you don't have to do the work. You have to do the work towards your dharma. And if your dharma is doing jyotish,
yeah.
It doesn't mean you have to suffer to do the hard work. You can enjoy doing the hard work too.
Exactly.
And I'm like, oh. Right, because Saturn, you think, is like always like,
yeah,
suffering and yeah. And I thought, okay, well, let's check it out.
It just makes us more mature.
Yeah. Oh yeah. You can have fun doing the work, right? We can have fun and do the work.
So your last name is coming from Daivya.
I think so, because look, in my knot, in our knot, we have Pandya, right?
Yeah.
My mother's maiden name is Vyas, right?
Uh-huh.
But Trivedi, so someone who knows three of the Vedas, Chaturvedi, Pandya, Bhat, Vyasa, and Dave, and one more, Joshi. Of course, how can I forget Joshi?
Uh-huh.
Joshi is what? Jyotish.
Yeah.
Pandya is Pandit, yeah? Vyasa is Veda Vyasa. Vyasa is my mother's, my mom, you know? And I always ask, what is Dave? Trivedi is someone with three knowledge of three Vedas. Chaturvedi is someone with four knowledge of four Vedas.
Wow.
So what is Dave? What is Dave? What is Dave? What is it? And what is Bhat? I don't know either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it comes from D-A-I-V-Y-A, Devya. Because Dave, Devya.
See ya. And I won't be here next week.
Okay.
It'll all be online.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Dave. Yeah. Dave is a Gujarat. This much I know. We're from Junagadh or Jamnagar. Junagadh. We're from Dave is how you pronounce it. But what is the root? What is the root? Dave. And you know how they mix up the V and the W, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's Dave. Dave. Brahman.
Dvivedi. Two Veda.
Oh, only two Vedas. Dave. Dave.
So,
Dave. Of course. Dave. Trive. Chaturve. Of course. Dave. Yes.
Yep.
So in my blood.
And it says Vedas, it should be Vedandra.
Right. And in my blood, my lineage is Vyas and Dave.
Uh-huh.
You know? And Joshi. My grandmother was Joshi. So this studying did I tell you, Frida? My paternal grandfather was a Jyotish, and my maternal grandfather was a Vedya.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done both the Ayurveda, and now I'm doing the Jyotish. So I also feel like the ancestors supporting, you know?
100%.
I feel.
You should make sure you feed them on Amavasyas.
Okay. And they're like, what is this Western psychology, mycology? What is this?
That's called money. That's called how you're going to make money doing it all.
See you next week.
Yep, see ya.
We'll see, guys. Not one word. Maybe I'll be famous.